Welcome back. It is a good day to talk to Sridhar Ramesh. I am your host, Duncan, and joining me shortly will be my co-hosts, Gardner and Forbes. On today's episode, we will be interviewing comedian and mathematician Sridhar Ramesh, known for his jokes on his Twitter page, at Radish Harmers. And then after the interview, we talk about his choice of film, Airplane. This episode is releasing Monday, February 20th. And we know we took a break from releasing new episodes, but we will now be back with weekly releases. Later this week, we will be joined by filmmaker Ben Young, who was a guest on the show last year, to discuss his new film, Devil's Peak, which is out in theaters in the US now. So get excited for that. Go see the film in theaters. But that episode will also be spoiler-free for those of you who can't see it in time. Today's episode was recorded a few months ago, and we've been excited to share it with you. But fortunately, we believe it's just as relevant today as it was when we taped it. It's a great interview, and we want to thank Sridhar for taking the time to join us. We really think you're going to love it. And since it's a long one, we're going to get right into it. So without further ado, here it is, our interview with Sridhar Ramesh.
We are joined now by a very special guest, Sridhar Ramesh, who is known online for his humor as well as his knowledge of high concept mathematics, is here to talk with us today. We're going to start off by talking to Sridhar about his work on comedy, math, and other things, and then we're going to transition into a discussion about his choice in film, Airplane. Sridhar, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
How did we do on that background? Is there anything that you would want to add?
No, I think you hit it. It's sort of distressing to realize I only have two qualities in a way. I mean, comedy and math, those are the only things I do, but that is the only two things I do. So, yeah.
Hey, it's more than me. Looking forward, I think this is going to be an entirely different kind of interview altogether.
This is going to be an entirely different kind of interview.
Oh, I'm so dumb. I missed it. I'm wondering, why are you saying it like that?
We're very nervous about our ability to do that on Zoom.
So just jumping right into the interview and asking you about yourself, can you tell us a little bit about what seems to me to be your twin loves for math and for comedy and how those work together? And if I'm off base, let me know.
Sure. No, you're not off base. As I said, those are my two qualities. I think, so to me, there is synergy between them, or I think they have similarity, even though, like, I don't know any other comedians who are any good at math or any other mathematicians who are particularly funny. So the synergy does not often manifest. But to me, they're both about playing with logic. They're both about you come up with some twist, some absurd premise, whatever, and then you play out, okay, if this is true, then what else is true, as the UCB motto goes. But that's also what math is all about. So I don't know what led me, you know, I don't know how a personality is formed, but I've always been interested in playing with logic. Even when I was a kid, these were my two interests for comedy and math. So yeah, I mean, that's what I would say. They both come from some interest in logic, I guess.
And were you always interested? Were you like a high level math student in school and then like you were a class clown, or was that something that came later?
Yeah, both of those were there pretty early on. So I can say I remember this. When I started, I mean, it's pretty early on, but when I started first grade, I didn't think of myself as a math person at all. Like, who cares? But I remember I always used to get in trouble with the teacher. I was a goof off in class or whatever. And I wouldn't do my work. I just wouldn't care about it. And then the teacher would send all the other kids off to recess. And she'd say, I have to stay. I didn't do the work. I got to stay after. And then she would just give me this work that everybody else had done all morning. And she'd say, you had to go home and do it as homework. And then I'd come off and I'd join my other friends in recess like 10 or 15 minutes later. But they all thought I was so smart because they were like, oh, you just did in 15 minutes what we took all morning doing. But they didn't know. I was just doing it at home as homework. They didn't realize I was the only kid in fifth grade with that. But I liked that they all thought of me as smart. Like, it was all a fraud. It wasn't based on anything real. But it made me think, oh, I like when people think of me as smart. So I think somehow that ended up also pushing me into being interested in math. And then there was this other thing that happened in first grade. My mom, I had come to her. I'm telling this rambling story. Feel free to cut me off. But I had asked my mom at one point about this thing that in class you learn kind of rotely all this stuff. Like, nobody gives you any understanding of anything. But there's this thing I noticed, you know, at some point, or it was like implicit in class, that it's about multiplication, basically. It's dumb, but you know, if I take 3 plus 3 plus 3 plus 3 plus 3, let's say 5 threes, I add them together. Or if I take 5 plus 5 plus 5, 3 fives, I add them together, you get the same result, right? The order of multiplication doesn't matter. 3 times 5, 5 times 3, if you think of it as repeated addition, it comes out to the same thing. But this is just kind of something they said a lot rotely in class. They never gave us like an explanation. And so I went to my mom and I was like, why does this happen? It's just this kind of dumb question, I guess. Not that dumb. I mean, it's a good question. But my mom gave me this explanation. She's like, oh, well, you draw a rectangle and it has, let's say, 3 rows and 5 columns, and you can count it this way or count it that way. You're going to get the same answer. And that completely just opened up my mind. I was like, oh, wow, there's reason to things and you can understand them. And I was very taken with that argument. I mean, that was really the first time that I found myself very interested in math. And so from that point on, I kind of knew there's more to math than what they ever tell you in school. Like, things actually have explanations that you never get to see in school, and you can just think about it. And so my whole life, I realized math class in school is boring. Like, I agreed with everybody else about that. My only interest in math was because I found time to think about it outside of school. And so, yeah, I mean, I have a million stories like that, but I never cared about it. In school, they will give you like 50 problems and they're all exactly the same. Multiply this 2-digit number by this 2-digit number, and then multiply this 2-digit number by this 2-digit number, and whatever. Just be a human calculator and do the same thing 50 times. And that's the most boring thing in the world. Like, who cares? I understood it the first time. I already get it. The conceptual content is all that matters. So math class for me was about as bad as it is for other people, except I could understand what was going on, but it was still boring. But I would go to the library or stuff and get books on other math, or just kind of recognize that, yeah, there's, you know, more to learn about it, more interesting stuff going on.
Maybe to chime in, like, I've noticed an astounding number of adults that don't get the sort of, I believe that's the multiplicative property. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not a mathematician, but like, you know, I had my friend the other day saying he was going to drink 12, 16 ounce beers. And how many beers was that? And I amazed him when I told him it was 16. And then I had to explain that, you know, it really doesn't matter which way you multiply them by. And it's, I do think there's a certain percentage of people that probably never learn the reason behind the math. They just learn the memorization.
Yeah, well, definitely there's a lot of people who never learn the reason behind things in math. And I was quite shocked, actually. I remember I was asking a friend of mine recently, just out of curiosity, if she could come up with like a good explanation for why the order doesn't matter in multiplication. She wasn't the math person, obviously. And she was just like, no, I've never thought about it and I do not care. And I cannot give you an answer. But I was shocked because to me, it's such a basic thing, that particular thing, that I thought probably every adult can give that argument. But no, I guess to a lot of people, it's just not the thing they care about, which is fine. On some level, it's fine that people don't care about math. I mean, everybody has their own interests. There's a million things I don't care about also. But some very basic things like that, it is sort of surprising or alien to me that you would just go your whole life just assuming these things and never thinking why. Like, everything I come across, I always, you know, I want to understand the why of it, I guess.
I imagine that lends itself very well to comedy, because a lot of comedy is about trying to get to like the truth.
So this is an interesting thing I think about comedy, which is that, you know, people like to talk about comedy as truth, but my philosophy is completely different, because I think the idea that comedy is truth has perverted things to where you go to a lot of stand-up and people just get up there and they're like, racism is bad. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, it's true, but where's the joke? So to me, like I said, it's about playing with logic. So it's like you take something false and then you try and justify it, or you tell some kind of story and you try and give it logical structure. So a lot of it relates to the rest of it, but you're still starting from a false place, or you're trying to make something up. You know, if I just wanted to see the truth, I'd go to a one-man show, and I don't do that because I don't care. I don't want to see the truth. But yeah, to me, it's all about making up jokes. And, you know, especially like I like to make up jokes where, okay, I'm a murderer, I'm a pedophile, I'm, you know, this or that, whatever. It's like, that's fun. But I don't want to get up there and be like, this is the trauma that happened to me when I was a child, and these are the annoyances I have with my parents, and who gives a shit, right? So to me, it's all about trying to make something sound true or to have some logical structure to it, but it's all a game. It's all made up.
And going off that, obviously, you just mentioned that there are topics that you think are fun to play with, and that shines through, I think, in some of your jokes. Obviously, some people might not. It might not be their style, obviously. Right. But going off that, do you think that there is, and just so everyone knows, you can find a lot of the really funny stuff that Sridhar has wrote going back years now on Twitter at Radish Armor. So I guess, is there like a style that you would say you have? Because for me, I feel like a lot of times that I could be reading this wrong, but it seems almost like not exactly wordplay, but it made sense what you were saying. thing where it's like you're not necessarily looking at it from a point of view. It's almost like, I feel like a lot of times, I don't know how to describe it, but I feel like you do have a style, if that
sense. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, probably everyone who does anything for a while has a style. Like every comedian has a style, every filmmaker has a style, every musician has a style. But yeah, I agree completely with what you said. Like, I'm trying not to only do edgy things or only do this or only do that. But every joke I do probably still comes from this same idea of, okay, I like things that have some logical structure to them. They're not very character-based or stuff like that, in the sense of, you'll see some comedians where it's just like, oh, they have this charisma in the way they act and the joke doesn't really work on paper, but it's like, you can feel the character they're creating or something. I don't do stuff like that. To me, everything has to be sort of very writerly, and there's really a, I'm using this word logical a lot, but it's true. It's something about the playing with logic that underlies a lot of them. Not 100%. Of course, I've done other kinds of jokes, but I think that is often how it is. There's like a real core explainable joke to probably 90% of what I do, where it's like, I kind of feel there's nothing, it's not so wrong or anything, but I feel there's a lot of jokes that I see in the world that are just like, oh, it's so wacky and random, but there's not really a real joke that you could explain in there.
And so you say you want like sort of a written-based comedy. Obviously, Twitter, you know, can be pretty brutal, pretty unforgiving. Is that kind of your main medium, the real only medium you have interest in? Like, sort of how have you kind of navigated that over the years?
Yeah, no, definitely my actual main interest is more like sketch comedy. I used to do a lot of sketch comedy, but I used to do it a lot when I was living in California. Even then, it was all very writerly, though. I only liked the sketch that you could see on the script why it was funny, not like stuff where, you know, the acting made it funny. Of course, it's great to have that synergy. But yeah, so sketch comedy is my main interest. But ever since I moved to New York a few years ago, which was partly with the goal of doing sketch comedy more ambitiously, I just happened to have bad timing. I got here a little bit before COVID, and I only, you know, did a couple things before COVID kicked in. I never found like a group to gel with. So I just haven't been able to get that off the ground again. Hopefully soon I'll be doing it again. But in the meanwhile, yeah, I've been probably doing just way too many tweets. I used to do stand-up and stuff too, and I'll probably go back into that. But definitely right now, the bulk of my creative output, so dumb as it is to say, could be found just on Twitter, just because it's easy. You know, you can go to an open mic and put out a bunch of jokes to, you know, some room of 20 people a few times a night. But like any time in the world that you have a thought, a joke in your head, you can just tweet it out immediately. So it's just like, there's a sense in which, of course, that's less real than all these other things. But it's also just like, I'll be doing 100 times the jokes if I just, you know, do that. So yeah, I don't know.
Is that tough, though, growing on Twitter in comparison to growing at like open mics and stuff, where you're not just doing that joke to 20 people, but you're doing it to the world? And Twitter, like Jeff said, can be pretty brutal and unforgiving. Has that been tough for you to kind of navigate?
Well, unforgiving in what sense? I mean, there's the sense that, you know, sometimes you'll get an audience for a joke who doesn't like jokes. I mean, that happens. But, you know, whatever. I don't mind that stuff. I mean, basically, nothing can happen to me if somebody doesn't like a joke I say, except that someone could go try and get me fired from my job, or, you know, try and get my account deleted or whatever. But other than that, there's no kind of cancellation I can suffer. Like, I don't have anything to be canceled from, you know, it's not an issue. So I don't mind if I do a joke that I think is good and other people don't like it. It is completely water off my back. I mean, I'm insecure, like, you know, I want people to like my jokes. I want people to think they're funny. But if some people think they're funny and other people don't like them, I really do not care that some people don't like them.
Did you always have kind of thick skin like that?
About jokes? I guess so. I mean, you know, probably when I was 5 years old, I didn't. But I don't remember telling a lot of offensive jokes when I was 5 years old or anything. And again, I don't feel like I only tell offensive jokes or anything, but when it happens. But yeah, well, you know, I was very shy as a child, actually. But later on in life, when I started being more outgoing, circa the end of middle school or something. Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Like, I can't remember any instance in history where I really got worried about some joke I told and people were offended. I don't know why that would be, that I never felt that way, but I guess I never did.
I guess just to give you some credit there, one of the reasons I'm most drawn to your comedy is that clearly you've crossed a few lines and, you know, you maybe have upset some people, but you don't go make it your personality where, oh, look at me, I'm the bad boy of comedy on the internet. You just kind of keep going with writing funny jokes.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say? And like, do you think like, because there's so many comedians now that offended someone 5 years ago and they're still talking about it, you know, that's their whole joke now.
Right. It's the have I triggered you kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right. It's the have I triggered you kind of thing. Yeah. No, that is boring also. So, I said earlier, there's a strain of stand-up that bores me where people come up and they just say, oh, racism is bad. But the other strain of stand-up you see, you know, particularly from older comedians, is they'll go up and all they'll do is say at the mic, you can't say anything anymore. You know, everything will yeah. be canceled. And I'm like, I have some sympathy for what you're saying, but it's not interesting to me. I came here for jokes. It's supposed to be a comedy show. What are you wasting my time with this for? So the flip side of the attitude that it doesn't, even ironically, as I'm talking about all this to you, saying it doesn't bother me and you shouldn't waste time talking about it, I am talking about it to you. But, you know, the flip side of the fact that it doesn't bother me if someone doesn't like my jokes is that I don't need to waste time trying to convince them or trying to make a big argument with them or be hung up on it. It's like, maybe I'll vent about it for a second and then move on to making more jokes. Yeah.
And talking about Twitter as a platform for getting your comedy out there, is it almost maybe a positive in the sense that, I know Gardner mentioned before the idea of trying a joke out, testing the audience reaction, couple different sets, maybe different locations, but you almost get to bomb right away, I feel like. And not in the sense where you're caring about people who, like you said, like aren't even there for jokes and it's now reached not the intended audience type thing, or, you know, half the audience might not always like it. Everyone's not going to think every joke is fun, obviously, even if they're there for the humor, but you're like, all right, well, maybe that one didn't work as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like you get to like really take a topic and just fire off everything you have. Like, I'm specifically, and it's not just the only time you've done it, but I know specifically there was two tweets and there was more on the topic as well, but they both started off, one was like, Muhammad had it right.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then the other one was Jesus had it right.
Yeah, that's right.
And then it was like about like not being recognized versus being recognized when you come back.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, you get to like, you're trying out both sides of it, I feel like.
I do that very often, yeah. Once I get an idea for something that I want to joke about, I'll try just every single variation that I can think of and then just see what one catches people's interest, exactly. Which again, is the thing you can do if you can just fire off every thought you have versus, okay, I've got my 5 minutes and I got to just pull what I think will do best. But again, of course, the flip side of this is there's a reality in some sense to stuff that isn't Twitter. But I like the idea that, yeah, I try out every single thing I can, and then I know what's worth exploring further. And then on occasion in the past, I've then taken something that was a tweet and then turned it into a sketch or whatever. I feel like a lot of people aren't good at that, but I feel like I have a reasonable sense of what has legs to become something more or not. Again, I've gotten lost in this question, but I think the point was, yeah, I like that idea of try everything, see what fails quickly, and then explore the ones that have legs.
And would you try, and I don't know, maybe you have done this, but I know you talk about sketch comedy, would you do like digital stuff?
Oh yeah, yeah. When I was doing sketch comedy years and years ago, we filmed a lot of stuff and put it online. I mean, if you look on YouTube, you find my old stuff. It's not all great. I mean, it was in a group, so everything's a compromise, but some of it was good. And that's really what I want to get back into. So when I say sketch comedy is what's most interesting to me, I like live stuff all right, but I really like the scope of ambition you can do when you film something and you take time to edit it, polish it, and it lives on forever. I always found it odd, the ephemerality of both of Twitter, as most people use it, and of live shows and everything. Like, you do a joke and whoever sees it, and then it's done. I'd rather, you know, do something really good and then have it to be able to show to anybody for years and years. I know nobody wants to see the same joke twice, but I can keep showing it to new people. So to me, yeah, filmed digital stuff is the dream.
Was there like a sketch group or a sketch show that you saw a lot when you were younger that made you want to do sketches?
Yeah, but you know, it's surely trite anything I say, because it's like, if you ask a musician what their inspiration was and they say the Beatles, then it's like, all right, whatever. But to me, Monty Python was the thing that really roused me from my dogmatic slumbers, so to speak. So when I was in middle school, which I guess is the time for this to happen, I would just rent every, you know, VHS of Monty Python I could find from Blockbuster. And I remember the first time I did this, for some reason I'd become aware of Monty Python, but I didn't really know anything about them. Through like Douglas Adams and stuff, I became aware of them. I rented Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and I took it home and I watched it, and I didn't laugh once because it was like different from everything I'd ever seen. I didn't really know what was going on, but even though I didn't laugh really, I could tell there was something interesting about about it. And so then I rented it again. And then I was like, oh, now I get it. Not like I was too stupid to get it, but somehow I just wasn't in the right place to funny. But then I was like, there's something interesting here. I want to rewatch it. And then it became, you know, very funny. And then I would be renting all these compilations like Dead Parrot Sketch Not Included. And now for something completely different and all these things where they would refilm the sketches that they had originally done on their show, but they'd film them better or something. I used to watch a lot of those. That was very influential to me. And then later on, I mean, if you want to say other sketch shows that I thought were very good, Mr. Show, I started watching in college, specifically because I saw somebody calling it the American Monty Python. I was like, all right, let me check this out. And then later on in life, when my sense of humor was more fully established, I was just watching things that I'll name that were good. Key and Peele, I thought was very good. They have this very cinematic ambition in the way they filmed their sketches, which I thought was very nice.
So speaking of Monty Python and specifically Holy Grail, which was something that I watched probably when I was not too young in the sense of like, oh, you saw this horror movie or this adult movie, but like, yeah, for the humor where it was like, I guess like
right.
Certain things, there's like, all right, I don't get why that's clever, I guess, or not.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know we have a couple more questions that we want to ask you, if that's all right.
Yeah, sure.
But to jump forward a little bit, obviously we're speaking about Airplane in a little bit, your choice in film today. And I do feel like not the same, obviously, but same family of humor, I would say.
Right.
The ZAZ stuff and the Monty Python stuff. Do you see, like, your, again, I know I'm asking now again almost the same question about your style of humor, but do you see your style being in the same family as those? Not necessarily in the satire sense, I guess, where I guess Monty Python is kind of tackling genres at points, and this is specifically a genre of movies, disaster movies, Airplane is, but it's also specific
right.
films or franchises. Do you see yourself, though, in that, I don't know what the word would be, semi-deadpan, again, like, wordplay often.
Yeah, it's like dry absurdity.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll let you answer, but just one last thing also is that I do think the Monty Python stuff has some of that surreal stuff as well, where it's like almost like it's like this is out of nowhere.
Right.
And you weren't saying you disliked it, but earlier you said that some of that stuff, maybe it was specifically talking about Twitter, but like, where's the punchline there?
Right, right.
It's just too random. But it is a little bit of that surreal realm, I guess.
Yeah, so there's moments like that in Monty Python, and it's true, I don't care for them all the time. So it's interesting, Monty Python is very influential to me, but I wouldn't say every single thing Monty Python did hit my funny bone, so to speak. But I'll say this is the thing with the Zazz movies or with Zazz everything, you know, TV shows or whatever, that appeals to me is, again, it's just all about the jokes. I mean, you'll be watching it and there'll be like four jokes a minute and it's not character driven at all. It's just, here's a gag, here's another gag, here's a second beat, here's a third beat on that gag. Let's find new ways to hit that thing sometimes. And they don't care about anything else. It's not really messagey or anything. And that is what I like about it. Not that I'm against ever watching things that are in other styles either, but that to me is what I really like about the Zazz stuff. Monty Python isn't quite the same as that. Monty Python has a lot of different styles coming together. But, you know, with Monty Python, what I really like is that there is a mix of cleverness and silliness. There'll be stuff that's very intelligent married to stuff that's just really stupid and silly. And that mix appealed to me.
This might be the world's dumbest comparison ever, but when you were talking about the idea that it's just, it is fast-paced and probably more fast-paced than we don't even get comedies anymore, but most of the kind of golden aught early right. teens age of comedies, this is way more jam-packed, although it's a completely different style, obviously.
Yeah.
And the idea that with that, there's less character-driven stuff and you can focus less on like a plot or a message.
Right.
It's almost reminiscent to me of Simpsons or those classic animated shows where things happen and then we go back to normal.
Right.
The beginning of next week type thing. It's like what happens in this last scene doesn't necessarily, like you could potentially have a character that falls out of an airplane or something like this.
Right.
And then they're in the next scene. You'd be like, all right, well, that was just a joke or something. Like, or, you know, a knight could, like, get killed and then he shows up later. And it's like, all right, well, that was funny the way we showed it, but
we're not
worried about that. I don't know. It seems like a dumb comparison, but that's where my mind went in saying that. It does, I think, lend itself to the joke more than the story then.
No, exactly. Yeah, everything's just in service of the joke. And you can break all the rules of, you know, the universe and just not worry about it just for a joke for a second. I like that style. Yeah.
Real quick, though, just because I know we've mentioned your math and we're on the topic of comedy right now, but maybe I can spice this in earlier.
Sure.
When we talk about you as a mathematician, I know I said high level math, but what would you define your area of expertise in math as?
Sure. I mean, it's very clearly set out because I, you know, went to grad school and had a specific thing that I was working on. I was doing my PhD in technically not a math department, but a logic department that was co-run by a math and philosophy department. So my area of specialty is what's known as mathematical logic. And within mathematical logic, my area of specialty is what's known as categorical logic, which is the application of a branch of mathematics called category theory to studying formal logic. Now, what category theory is very abstract, so it's maybe pointless to bother going into the details on it to a non-mathematical audience, but in high-level overview, it's a study of certain kinds of diagrams or shapes you can make with arrows. This is sort of, yeah, futile to try and explain, but some kind of thing about this very abstract study of how big things could be made out of putting small things together and diagrams with arrows and so on. That's this whole big branch of math called category theory, which has sort of exploded recently. It was invented in the 40s, but it's only more recently become sort of widely used because computer scientists sort of saw reason to investigate it. Anyway, my specialty was in applying that to formal logic.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like the basis of computer science to me. I was a computer science major. I'm not a mathematician. I got to Calc 3, and when we started working in 3D spaces, my brain stopped working.
Right.
But it sounds like the way you're describing it, kind of like all the hierarchy and object orientation and stuff like that, and only, you know, a million levels deeper.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And like you're saying, your fellow podcasters here probably wouldn't, myself included, get it, but, you know, definitely interesting.
Yeah. To be clear, I didn't mean to be dismissive of you guys. I was just saying, I imagine your audience is probably not full of only math PhDs.
No, it's okay. I think you're very accurate in dismissing us.
Yeah, no, the movie podcast, not so much.
Right. So anyway, in high level overview, my area of specialty in math was a field called logic, which makes sense for my saying my interest is logic. So a lot about, you know, if we make the rules of logic this, what can we prove or what can we not prove? And like tweaking the rules of logic too. That was a big part of what I was studying. So what I mean by tweaking the rules of logic is, well, I don't know if it's worth getting into, but for example, people are very familiar with some idea of what counts as a valid proof. Boolean logic, maybe you say everything is either true or false and P or not P always holds. That's certainly a natural system to study, but you could say, let me just change the rules a little and let's say, let me remove some of these rules and say P or not P doesn't always have to be true, but I'll allow these other rules from familiar logic. Just as a game, let's just do that. What can we prove and what can we not prove now if I tweak the rules that you're allowed to use in a proof? And then what's the use of this? Maybe this has some applications. Maybe I can find some way to interpret this system into the world in a different way than I would have interpreted classical logic. I'd have to give some examples for this to really make sense, but that was the sort of thing I was studying. Like what happens if you tweak the rules of logic? What can we say about things?
Sort of like a very base level comparison, but almost like an anti-joke. Like this shouldn't be funny, but it is in a way.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I could see some comparison there.
Again, this is going to be a base level reaction to that because, again, you're not even going into the high level specifics. Yeah. And so my interpretation, though, is that it's interesting in the sense that we were talking before about, for example, basic things that people at some point, most people know that you learn in school, like, for example, 3 times 4 equals 4 times 3, I think was the, or something along those lines. Was like the example we were using before. But that's why I always get annoyed, because I don't get annoyed, like, if someone doesn't remember, like, a rule like that. Although that one is surprising, like we were mentioning, because it just seems logical, like you were saying, right. Like, if you just apply logic, it would make sense. But then it's annoying when it's like the classic joke, I feel like it's for years now, but it's like, oh, another year and I still haven't used algebra or whatever math class is.
Right.
And it's like, no, you do, actually. You're using it all the time. I forget what they, like, a good example now, but like it's like anytime you're trying to like, what if we just divide this?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You're solving for X, you just don't realize it a lot of times when you're doing basic principles of it. And then also, well, maybe you should have used algebra because then you understand things that are honestly very basic. And not that any of us here, definitely not me, because I'm not trying to sound like an expert or anything. We're not trying to like diss anyone
right. For
not remembering these rules. But it is interesting then that like math gets a bad rap sometimes. And I'm like, well, pay a little more attention to it. And it actually can be super helpful in that logic sense.
Yeah.
That's like a logic game class that was like, again, very base level. It was like a 101 class for that. And it was like fun for me because it was like interesting because it's a game almost. Like you're trying to solve things. And it's like, I don't know, whenever I try to explain my interest in math, again, on a more base level, I'm like, picture like this big equation. And it's all these different like exponents, whatever you got, like whatever. I'm like, and then at the end, it's like X equals 7 or something. I'm like, doesn't that make you feel like you accomplished something? Like you beat that equation? I don't know. And like, to me, that's similar to the logic.
Yeah. And calling it a game is also a useful analogy because this is also part of what my interest in math was I really liked games and puzzles my whole childhood. So it's just like, you know, you could play a puzzle video game, right? You could be playing some kind of Tetris knockoff or something. And it's like, okay, you can move pieces like this and here's the setup and can you clear this board in 3 moves or something? Well, Well, a lot of math is like that too. But the thing with math that you don't get so much in video games is this kind of build up in power where it's like, oh, it's not all just these little one-off puzzles. It's like, once you understand this thing better, that helps you understand even more complicated things and so on. But it is still kind of a game. It's like, okay, if I give myself these rules, what can I show follows from these rules? And I can change the rules. I can make up whatever rules I want and I can investigate that game too. I feel like there's two things that people don't see in math and they're kind of opposite to each other, but they're the two things that school doesn't help people see. One of them is that you can make up whatever rules you want and study them. Like, there's actually a freedom to it. It's not handed down on stone tablets from God. Like, you're allowed to play with it. There's this creativity. But the other thing also school doesn't tell people is the rules that we're trying to teach you in school aren't completely arbitrary in that people investigated them for a reason. They were trying to model some particular thing. You know, when people say A to the B plus C equals A to the B times A to the C, somebody didn't make that up arbitrarily. It came from a reasoning, or this thing about 3 times 5 equals 5 times 3, like there's reasoning to it. So these are the two directions that are kind of opposite that people don't see in math, is both that the things you learn in school have meaning, they're not just made up rituals, but also you could make up other rules and play with them. And that's useful often too, because different things in the world act differently. Neither of those is what people see in school. All they see is this kind of boring drudgery of memorize this algorithm, this calculation procedure, be a little robot, run this drill, you know, 7 times and don't think about it. And it's just like a useless waste of time. I mean, we have computers to do unthinking stuff. The point of being a human being is to get to think and understand things.
I think it's really interesting. And as someone who's not a math guy, but enjoys comedy, I can see how a lot of this logic transfers over. For example, like playing around, inventing your own rules, seeing that sense of accomplishment when you eventually, you know, find out what X equals. That's like finding the punchline.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's also a thing. I sometimes think there are some jokes that the punchline is so perfect. I always think of it in my head as mathematically perfect. That happens sometimes, where you'll stumble upon a joke and you'll be like, how did nobody ever think of this before? And then you'll go look it up and be like, oh, 700 people thought of it before. But still, it'll be like, oh yeah, this is the perfect punchline. That's sort of an analogy or some kind of similarity sometimes, I think, to math. Sometimes you'll find something and you'll be like, it's clearly the best thing that could fit here. The other thing I want to say about math while I'm rambling is a lot of people think math is just about numbers and calculation because they never get to see that it really is about logic and you can apply logic to anything. So like you were saying, math comes up in everybody's lives in a way. Everybody does reason about things in their lives all the time. They're just not that good at thinking abstractly sometimes. So they don't generalize an insight from one thing to seeing, oh, this applies to a million other things. But a lot of things that you do in your life where you're just reasoning, oh, I need this thing in order to be able to do that. And if I have the two of these, then I can do that. That is mathematics, even if there's no numbers and no multiplication and exponentiation and whatever involved. And so, you know, even if you're just playing like a game of tic-tac-toe and trying to think, where do I have to move to not lose or something like that, that is all mathematics. And there are huge branches and fields of math where nobody ever touches a number. In my dissertation, for example, numbers do not come up except in a kind of trivial sense where sometimes I'll be like, this is number one and this is number two of the two things I have or something. But a lot of math really is just about other things you can apply logic to.
So that being said, as maybe like the world's foremost comedian that's also a math PhD, maybe there's some others, I'm not sure, does it kind of kill you inside that the biggest math discussion on Twitter is like people misinterpreting PEMDAS or, you know, those sorts of things?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so annoyed by that. Yeah. That annoys me all the time. It's not just on Twitter, like all over the internet, all over the world. The thing that's annoying about that is that it doesn't engage with what math really is.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this purely notational ritual that people are worried about. It's all just about the way you write things. It's not about what they're actually meaning. And we could just write things differently and none of this would have ever come up. But because this is the kind of thing teachers stress, is these mechanical rituals about notation or whatever, that's all people think math is. So these PEMDAS things are just about saying something ambiguously and then asking someone, do you know the rules that I use to disambiguate? But, you know, that's just a fact about language, about English. You can say something ambiguously. I can say, John doesn't like Bob because he's rude. Does that mean John is rude or Bob is rude? Well, there's ambiguity. And in real life, if this came up, you would just ask somebody to clarify. And the same thing with all these little PEMDAS rituals people put online. I mean, these PEMDAS challenges, like they'll write 6 plus 7 divided by 9 equals, I don't know, whatever they write. But in real life, mathematicians don't write like that. Like, you actually are having a conversation with the people you talk to, and you try and write clearly, and you'll ask somebody for clarification, whatever. It's just having a conversation in ordinary language. They're not like computers. You know, the thing you learn in school is just how to be a robot. So it's just a complete misunderstanding of what math is about, and it doesn't engage. The real things that are interesting about addition and multiplication are, you know, they're things like the commutativity that we were talking about before, 3 times 5 equals 5 times 3, or multiplication distributes over addition or whatever. Those have meaning. They aren't just about the way that you wrote the symbols down on paper, but people don't get a strong sense that math is about anything other than arbitrary symbol shuffling rituals. So yeah, that's annoying to me. I can only agree with what you said. It's like, actually, let me say one other thing. It's like if music class in school, which also probably isn't great, like nothing that people teach in school is great, but it's like if you went to music appreciation class in school and you never listened to music, you just learned a bunch of rules about how to write staves and clefs, and this is the symbol for a 16th note, this is the symbol for an 8th note, and it was all just about the calligraphy of that notation, and oh, make sure to put the measure bar here and whatever, but nothing about actually listening to music or playing music or dancing or anything. That's kind of like how math class is taught.
Well, it's funny you bring up music, because I feel like it's generally perceived in the inverse way that math is perceived in popular culture, where I think most people have a general sense of like what sounds good and what rhythm is, and they could, if they had the right tools like GarageBand or something, they could get together and they could put together something that has somewhat of a decent melody and flow, but they couldn't necessarily read a sheet of music,
right,
and play it on the piano, but they get it intuitively. And then when you throw that at them with the very rote notation, that kind of thing, that's where it confuses them, because it's not a, again, intuitive method of learning. You're not applying it to something that they experience.
Right, right. But in that sense, they're correct in a way to be like, the notation is a separate thing from the thing that actually matters. Although the notation is useful in music for certain purposes, but it's also true that a lot of great musicians, you know, like the Beatles, I don't think they knew how to read or write traditional, you know, classical sheet music notation, but they were doing a different thing that, I don't know, it didn't matter to them. Sorry, I may though have missed a point of what you're getting at, but the thing there is with music, at least everybody understands what it's actually about. They have this sort of direct experience of it. Nobody shows people what math is actually about. So the only thing they know to think it could be about is the sheet music. Music, so to speak, is the notation. And the problem is because math is abstract. So I always feel like, and forgive me if I'm going on a wild tangent away from what you were trying to talk about, but I always feel a little bit jealous of scientists, for example, because you can watch a pop science program, it'll get everything wrong, whatever, but you'll at least know, oh, right, it's about planets and molecules and this and that. And on that level, they're correct. Like, scientists do study planets and molecules and chemicals and whatever. And they're like concrete things that people can, even if they don't know any science, they'll be like, I know that's what they're talking about. They're talking about that thing in the sky, or how to make this thing move fast or whatever. But math is abstract. It's all about studying the rules of logic, which aren't supposed to be specific to any particular thing. I'm not supposed to be talking about 5 sheep or 5, you know, bales of hay. I'm supposed to be talking about the rules that I can apply in general to lots of things. And that makes it a little bit harder, I think, for a lot of people to grasp or even know how to talk about it, because they aren't trained to think abstractly. And if you try and talk abstractly to them, they only want you to make things very concrete. But the significance of the study of math is the generality and abstraction. So it's hard to do a pop science thing on math. Like, you don't have good things to show photos of or anything. And for that reason, I think a lot of people never get to see what math is really about. Whereas for almost everything else, it's more concrete. So even if you don't know the subject well, somebody can at least tell you this is what it's about and point to something like music or science or whatever everyone knows what they're about.
And I feel like video games have probably bridged some of that gap. Like, I'm sure there's 12-year-olds who are building logical gates and computers on Minecraft.
Yeah, yeah.
Then meanwhile getting like a C in Algebra 1 or something, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly right. Exactly. Which is why I was trying to say earlier, this thing about math being about games and puzzles. I feel like probably in my life, because I say I only have 2 interests, right? Comedy and math. When I was a child, I had 3 interests, comedy and math and video games. And probably that was a huge part of how I became interested in a lot of stuff in math too. Or computer science also. I had a background in computer science as well because I wanted to make video games. Like, that was the driving force for a lot of my interest in tinkering with these, you know, rules of logic. So, yeah. I mean, I remember as a child, for example, you would just get these like computer games that are kind of edutainment maybe, but like, you know, Math Rabbit or something. I don't know if people 20 years younger than me or whatever. No.
Mavis Beacon.
Well, Mavis Beacon's about teaching typing, but yeah. Is there Mavis Beacon for math actually? I don't know. Maybe there is.
There's got to be these days.
I think there was a whole suite of Mavis Beacon. She was prolific.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I remember Math Blaster.
Yeah. Math Blaster.
But that was still very much like you're just putting the sheet of 50 edition questions onto a bunch of bugs and aliens jumping around.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, a lot of those things aren't good either because they're just making you do computational drills. But I do remember when I was a child, I don't remember what it was in, but there'd be computer games that had puzzles in them. And sometimes the puzzles would have mathematical elements like, you know, this puzzle, sometimes people call it lights out. For example, you have a grid of lights and whenever you press one light, it toggles that light and it toggles the lights next to it to go from on to off or off to on. And you start in some pattern and you want to make them all go off or something. Or for example, like a Rubik's Cube is a kind of mathematical game. Or there's something called Tower of Hanoi where you have three pegs and you have blocks of different sizes and you can only put smaller blocks on bigger blocks and you need to move them between pegs. I'd see puzzles like this in video games sometimes and I'd try to solve the puzzle. But as I'm thinking about solving this puzzle, I'm also thinking, okay, I really want to understand what I'm doing, not in a specific way, but how do I solve a whole lot of different puzzles that are like this, but something changes. You know, that's the power of math is to start thinking, okay, I want to have like a general technique or understand something abstract. So that, you know, that often pushed me to think about things like Lights Out. I remember, you can stop me at any point, but Lights Out, I remember seeing this puzzle in a computer game in elementary school and thinking about it for a bit and having some insights, but not everything that I need to solve it. And then I saw this puzzle again in like a handheld electronic thing in like a toy store in seventh grade. And my mathematical skills had improved a bit. I've been, you know, learning more things about more things. And I realized, oh, this is about vector spaces. And it doesn't matter what moves I make, the order I make them in. All that matters is if I press something an odd or an even number of times. And there's all kinds of insights I started to have. And I realized, oh, this is a very mathematical game. And I can just kind of like solve it. I can just think about things. And I can realize the patterns and be like, oh, if I combine this with that, I can solve this configuration. Anyway, sorry, I'm rambling. But stuff like that was always influential to me. I mean, puzzles have existed long before video games, but that was definitely an avenue where I became interested in them or saw a lot of them. Yeah. You know, this other puzzle, I'm just going to ramble about puzzles for a while, but
do it.
You know, this sliding blocks puzzle where you have this 4x4 grid and like one spot is empty and you can move a tile into the empty thing up, down, left, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a very influential puzzle for me as a child too. And it turns out historically that puzzle was the subject of a big math thing in the 1800s, actually, long before the modern electronic versions. But somebody offered a big cash prize to anybody if they could solve a particular configuration of that puzzle, unscramble a particular configuration. And eventually mathematicians gave a proof that it couldn't be solved. And it was part of the development of something called group theory, studying permutations. Certainly as a child, I would not have been able to realize, oh, I can't solve this configuration because of this math thing or whatever. But I was thinking about things like that just from playing around with puzzles like that. So, and you know, we all see puzzles like that. Like you were saying, you've played with puzzles like that too. I feel like if in math class, they spent less time making kids be robotic calculation, you know, machines and more time being like, here's a puzzle, play with it. Tell me what kind of discoveries you've made with this puzzle. Like you'll have some insights. You'll be like, oh, I have realized I can always do this kind of move to deal with this kind of configuration and stuff. That would show children that you can discover things in math yourself. Like you don't need somebody else to tell you everything. There's this playing around and discovering things as part of being a human being. And that would make it exciting. That would make it more fun. Still, some people wouldn't care about it, of course, but some people would care about that more than, oh, I'm just doing something I can put into a calculator anyway. Why am I the dumb guy doing it?
Going off that, isn't, and this maybe is something that people have said forever, I'm just thinking I'm discovering it for the first time now, but is chess not basically like a math logic puzzle in that sense?
Chess is.
I mean, you can teach a computer to like make the right move every time, right? I don't know. I feel like that's very like, I mean, we were talking binary or like Boolean type stuff earlier. If you can teach a computer, I feel like, I mean, that's all logic, right? Teaching an AI to do a game.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are people who do chess puzzles, so to speak. Like they'll give you a thing in the newspaper that says you're in this configuration, you have to reach checkmate in three moves or whatever. So those are also puzzles of this sort. The one thing about chess though, which is true of a lot of puzzles you'll find in a video game or something also, though, is it is basically a math problem, but it's a very kind of arbitrary, complicated math problem where the rules aren't going to generalize a lot. Like, you're not going to find a lot of situations in life where you're like, oh, I can map onto this that there's one piece that moves diagonally and one piece moves like a knight, whatever. So it's very kind of arbitrary and specific. And that's the thing that distinguishes it from some other things that you might study that are much more generalizable. Like when you start talking about addition and multiplication of counting numbers, this comes up in a million situations. Five sheep, five bales of hay, 5 miles I run. They all follow the same kind of rules. But even like a game like tic-tac-toe or something, the rules are a lot simpler. It's some hope, some possibility you might run into those same rules again in some other context versus chess, which is just extremely specialized. So it is mathematical, but the skill of being a good mathematician in a way is also knowing how to pick problems to study that will come up in lots of contexts, or how to abstract and generalize. So the thing about chess that is useful for a math person is to think, let me forget some of the specifics of the rules of chess, but let me just think about the whole class of games that chess represents. Two-person games, you take turns, and there's no randomness, and there's no hidden information, and the game has to eventually end, and somebody wins or loses, or you tie or something. There's a lot of games like that, but they all have some things in common, and you can start thinking about what they have in common and what that tells you about how to come up with strategies for all of these games. And people have done that. They've studied something called combinatorial game theory, which is about that kind of thing. And you can come up with insights like, okay, for any game like that I just said, two-person, turn-taking, has to end eventually, win, lose, or draw. No matter what, either one player has a strategy that can't be beaten, or the other player has a strategy that can't be beaten. Now, that's not true of every game in the world. For example, rock, paper, scissors, there's no unbeatable strategy. There's always the possibility that you play something that the other person beats. But for some games, it is true, and there's like a reason for it. Okay. And then you can build off of that also. You can say, okay, how do I come up with an algorithm that computes the unbeatable strategy? And people thought about that, and sometimes it's, you know, within the realm of feasibility. Everybody knows how to do it, but sometimes it takes too long to run. And then people honed that, and then they made computer programs that could play chess, but the same theory behind those computer programs could also have been honed to play Go or tic-tac-toe or whatever. There's a lot they have in common. And so that's the power of abstraction. If you spend your whole life thinking, I'm just trying to solve chess, you only learn about chess. And that's what chess players do. There's the stereotype that chess players are intelligent, and it's not really true. Chess players are just extremely specialized at this one skill. But what's intelligent is saying, I'm not going to hone my whole life just trying to study this one dumb game. I'm going to try and study what games in general are like and what I can apply across all of them, and then how to recognize when I have to bring in something specific about this particular game and whatever.
So I guess, like, safe to say you're more into like the sort of Google DeepMind, like Gatto generalist. What would you do in a chess game if all the pieces were shuffled at the beginning versus like furthering to optimize chess and bringing a vibrator into the world championship?
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know that vibrator thing, that anal beads thing, incidentally, just as trivia. I know the guy who started that whole rumor. He didn't mean it in sincerity. He was just making a joke in a live streamed like Twitch chess commentary thing. He made a joke that the host ended up reading out loud from the chat, and then started all this speculation, but he never meant for it to be taken seriously. But now everybody thinks the guy actually had a vibrator.
Nice. We get some breaking news.
But yeah. But anyway, yes, it's true. I'm much more interested in the whole space of possibilities instead of being like, let me memorize openings and end games for chess. You know, that's what professional chess players do, right? They memorize all these very intricate, specific things that would completely stop working if you changed any of the rules.
Makes sense.
Is it safe to say then, or fair to say, that there's more value, or some value, I guess, in looking at how someone approaches it more than...
Yeah, that might be right.
Maybe that'll tell you how they approach other logical type things.
Yeah, that could be true. I've never really spoken to a chess player in depth, but it might be interesting to see how they analyze things and if there's something in their method that would be generalizable. But I'm kind of pretty convinced that most chess players are kind of dumb. You look at Garry Kasparov, for example, and whenever Garry Kasparov talks about anything that isn't chess, well, he's kind of a conservative wingnut, but he's just, you know, a dumb guy in general. But yes, there's much more value in the general idea of how to analyze games. games rather than the memorized specifics of one particular thing. Here's another example of a thing people think makes you smart. They used to think it made you smart, but people like to talk about neurosurgeons as people who are very smart because a neuro is in the name, I guess, and they work with brains. But a neurosurgeon isn't someone who's smart. A neurosurgeon is just someone who has steady hands. So Ben Carson, I think, has laid to rest this rumor that neurosurgeons are very smart, but we used to think that.
I was hoping you were going to bring up Ben Carson.
Yeah, I see. What is he doing these days? I forget. I guess now he's not in the administration. He was something during the Trump administration, right? Like a housing guy?
He was the director of housing and urban development.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I thought. Which again, like why?
Which goes right hand in hand with surgery.
Yeah, exactly. Hand in steady hand. But yeah. It doesn't make any sense.
So not to be like the board game / children's game guy now, but I'm just thinking now, what about, is there value in approaching things like, isn't there things about like Connect Four, like you should, I think like you should go in the middle on the first try?
Sure. Well, I'll say this about statistics certainly applies to lots of games that you might study that have an element of hidden information or randomness. So something like poker or something like rock, paper, scissors, although the theory there is very simple. But Connect Four, actually, a proper study of Connect Four doesn't really involve statistics because it's among this class of games like chess that I was saying where there's no hidden information, no randomness. There really is a perfect strategy to be unbeatable in Connect Four if you're the right player. Obviously, the first player and the second player don't both have unbeatable strategies, but there's one player in Connect Four who has a perfect winning strategy. Unfortunately, people don't yet have it fully computed. The state space is too large, I believe, for Connect Four. But there is a book, a very famous book in mathematics, a multi-volume series of books, actually, called Winning Ways for Your Mathematical Plays. It was made by these mathematicians, Berlekamp, Conway, and Guy. Conway is a very big mathematician. And it discusses Connect Four, among other board games of this sort. And it gives a lot of the theory of Connect Four. It doesn't fully solve it, but it develops a lot of general theory for games of this sort and then applies it to Connect Four. And, you know, a lot of it is just about little things. For example, I've noticed, I'm definitely rambling. I forgot what my point is, but I'll just keep rambling. I've noticed that when I play Connect Four with people, I'm unbeatable. But it's not that I know the unbeatable strategy. It's just nobody that I'm playing with bothers to do things like think three moves ahead, understand like pins and forks. Like if you set up a situation where you have three things in a row with a blank on both sides, you'll win because they can't block both sides. And then be on the lookout for any opportunity your opponent has to do stuff like that. Now, this is all very general stuff. Like these ideas apply to lots of games. The same thing happens in chess. People think about pins and forks and so on. But that's the sort of thing that goes into the theory of Connect Four. It's not statistical because you don't have to worry about your opponent doing something random. You have to worry about your opponent doing the best possible thing they could do, which is some kind of clearly defined mathematical thing for Connect Four. But there are other games, certainly, like poker, where statistics comes in. Although, again, it's funny with poker, there was this cheating scandal recently. But, you know, when I was growing up, everybody always talked about poker like it wasn't about the statistics and the cards. It was about the mind game and the bluffing and the reading people. But now it seems like the way pros work is they just become really good at knowing the statistics and they just play purely the statistics. And then if you do play the mind game and the bluffing and so on, or the soul read, then people are like, you're cheating. So it's odd. Apparently professional poker is it's apparently a more boring game in reality than everybody always said it was. Speaking of poker, I used to work for this math YouTube channel that's very popular called 3Blue1Brown. They have millions and millions of subscribers. But when I got that job, I had a job interview with the guy who runs it. And after the interview, he invited me to some poker game he was running. And then it was like, oh, is this like a secret part of the interview where he wants to see how good I am at probability or whatever. But I remember I went to that game and it was him and like all these other like math friends he had. And they were all clearly kind of trying to use statistics to play. Like they were just playing what would be statistically good hands and whatever. And I completely cleaned up the table by just deciding that's not how I'm going to play. I'm just going to make a bunch of bluffs and set them up so that, okay, I'll reveal this hand so they think I'm not going to bluff that much and I'm a kind of conservative player. And then I'll make a huge bluff next time. They won't call me on it, whatever. And I was purely focused on that and I completely crushed them and I got the job. But it was always funny to me that the guy who, invited me to that, who was running that channel, was really just trying to Like, he was really into probability and applying it to poker and whatever. And that was the opposite of how I won that little secret math interview. So
yeah, I've heard with poker that the best players in the in-person tournaments are a completely different group of people than the best players in the online tournaments, because the online tournaments are just repetitive probability, like,
oh, right,
models and learning every last combinatorial aspect of the game. And then, of course, in person, there's what you're describing, where it's all the, you know, mind games and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
The talk about bluffing and poker reminds me of, and this is, I don't know how many years ago now, because it's definitely been a long time since I've played this game, but when I would play Clue with people, and this is, again, not like to diss the people I was playing with, I don't remember, like, but in general, I think people weren't that, like, three steps ahead thing that you were saying with Connect Four, for example, as well. You could just totally destroy most people's logical idea of it by just, like, guessing your own thing once. Like, all right, well, he doesn't have that.
Right, yeah.
And, like, you do it once, obviously, with a group of people, and they're like, all right, now we have to be aware of that.
Yeah.
I feel like, in general, like, people, again, like, not like the chess masters when they're playing chess, and that's more, again, like you were saying, a different type of thing, like remembering stuff. But Clue is one of those things where there is the lying,
yeah,
all cards aren't on the table type thing, right, like with poker.
Right.
So I do think that, again, not like if there is a Clue championship, I'm sure they're all well aware of that. But it is interesting in general how I think if you're playing with friends casually, like there is some level of competitiveness where you're going to think about certain things. But like you said, there are people who are definitely not thinking those three steps ahead, for example.
Right. Right. Yeah, exactly. And like you said, it is always, I haven't played a lot of Clue, but with poker, for example, it is always useful to, like, have a room of strangers who don't know you. You can completely influence their perception of what you're going to do or whatever, and then completely throw it off by doing the opposite later. So yeah, I don't know. I always like playing poker when I'm walking into a room where, if people know me, then they know I'll be bluffing or whatever. If they don't know me, then I can make them think I'm one kind of player and then be another kind. So
last game thing that I'm going to bring up, it's similar also to card counting, where I think people maybe, like you were saying earlier, have that perception of you have to be like a genius to be able to do that, like the chess masters, where it's like, it's really like, isn't it one up, one? I haven't read any of the books on it.
Yeah, no, it's just a little robotic rule.
If it's like a face card or like a 10 or up, it's like plus one.
Yeah.
It's like, it's really not that complicated. And there are other things, I think, like, and maybe this is just like movies, but I remember Hangover, for example, I think is the first time I saw it in a movie, and maybe they did it completely wrong, but it was like, you needed to have someone else at the table or a different table. Like, so I don't know if they were going too in depth with that, but generally it is, like, I think less in depth than what people think, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not an expert card counter. I don't really know the ins and outs, but my understanding is that, first of all, in pure theory, it is something a robot could do. Like, it's just, you keep track of what cards have been played, whatever. So everything else is just about kind of optimizing it to be within the feasibility for your brain to keep track of. But all of that stuff doesn't demonstrate any intelligence. People think it does because an MIT team went and did it. But intelligence isn't about doing something that a computer could do for you. It's not about the robotic stuff. It's about understanding things and coming up with new insights and all the stuff that's not mechanical is what intelligence is. So it's always very funny what people associate with it. But yeah, I should not pretend that I know the ins and outs of card counting, but I will say they're probably all dumb. They're probably all just idiot savants. I mean, it's counting, right? I mean, kids can count.
Have you kind of ruined any video games for yourself? Like, I know I used to get really into playing Civ and beating it the highest difficulty with every character. And then I found after a while I was having the least fun I'd ever had playing the game. And, you know, like, it's just like, hey, it's actually a lot more fun if you just kind of go into it and don't min-max every last decision. And if you learn a new game with your friends, like, don't overthink about everything, you know, beforehand.
Well, I can't think of it right now, but there have been games that had been kind of like puzzle games of a sort where I sat down and thought about it and I completely cracked the whole, you know, genre of puzzles. I could solve every single one without thinking about it. And to me, that was fun, but it also does sort of, you know, destroy the game.
Yeah.
Here's a game that I ruined in a different way that luckily was recoverable. But again, it's a puzzle game. Do you know this game Yoshi's, what is it called? Or Tetris Attack. It was this game that was released on the Super Nintendo when I was a kid. It's some puzzle game. You move tiles around. When they match in certain ways, they disappear. It's not really proper Tetris, but, you know, that's the similarity. Anyway, I remember I was playing this game at one point, and I got stuck on a puzzle, and I couldn't figure it out. And I decided I would just write a computer program to solve the puzzles. And it was, you know, it's an interesting learning experience. figuring out how to write a program that would do it feasibly in a short enough time. But I did it, and then I was just running the program on every puzzle I got to the moment I had a moment of frustration. And that was dumb, of course, because then it's like, okay, I got rid of all the fun. But then eventually I learned, okay, I'm trying to use the program. But yeah, those are the kinds of things that I have ruined in a way, is when you fully solve the whole genre of puzzle. But yeah, I'm trying to think of, you know, more interesting examples of ruining things or of learning to let go and not trying to optimize. I mean, it's definitely that thing that happens sometimes too, is I have to learn to be like, I'm just playing this for fun. Who cares? Like, I don't need to fully figure it out, and don't get worked up about it. But I can't think of a good example right now. There was something else I wanted to mention. I just wanted to say, there was this game that I played as a kid also. I'm just thinking of things that I think were probably influential to me. There's this game called The Incredible Machine. None of you seem to have recognized it, but it was a puzzle game that came out when I was a kid. I'm much older than all of you. And it's just like these Rube Goldberg type machines you'd make by putting parts together in various ways to try and accomplish some goal, and you'd have limited parts and whatever. And I played that game a ton as a kid, and I wasn't thinking about it as mathematical at the time, but I'm sure it's that same kind of strengthening of, you know, the same skills, the same, you know, brain moves that played hand in hand with my interest in math as a young kid. So shout out to Jeff Tunnell and Dynamics or Interactive or whoever made The Incredible Machine.
So just to bring it back to some of the overall ideas of the questions and answers so far, we talked a lot about logic, obviously, and comedy and how logic works in both comedy and math. Are there other comedians that you do think manifest the idea of reason and logic in their comedy?
That's a good question. I mean, like, you know, in a less overtly mathematical way, or less, you know, they're not mathematicians, but they have that same style.
Right.
That is a good question. It must be the case. Certainly, probably any comedian I like has an element of that to their style. But if you were to ask me to really pin it down, see, I don't know who to say. Anybody I would say is kind of dumb. I'm not dumb as a person. I mean, it's a dumb thing for me to say. Yeah, I don't know. For example, I'll say this. I said earlier this thing about mathematically perfect punchlines. Now, there's some comedians who I think often reach the mathematically perfect punchline. But if I were to say, oh, I feel like they exhibit math in comedy, you would say I was crazy. Obviously, they're not actually thinking about math. But for example, I often feel like Norm Macdonald, he just finds the obvious funny thing to say, but he says it so correctly. Like, he finds the obvious thing about some setup that makes it funny. But obviously, he's not actually thinking about math or anything. But I find, and it's interesting because he also has elements of his style that are the opposite of what I do or whatever. I mean, he'll tell lots of like raconteurish stories and stuff. I don't do anything like that. But there are some jokes of his where I'm like, yes, that's exactly right. You honed in on the thing that's funny and you just did it straight with no frills. Like, he talks a lot of, he likes the setup and the punchline to be the same. And I feel like that somehow relates to the idea of there is a clear joke, the logic of the joke, and it's not about the acting out or whatever. It's that joke.
The deeply closeted gay man.
Exactly. That is such a perfect mathematical joke. Exactly. It's like a thing where there's this self-referentiality that negates itself. That, to me, it's like, okay, it's like the liar paradox or girls in complete hysteria or something. That's the kind of phenomena that joke evokes. So yeah, exactly. I'm so jealous of that particular joke. Yeah.
Again, I think my understanding of being able to do surreal or absurd deadpan, actually, when I first asked the question, in the note, it says like Stephen Wright and Norm were the two examples that I thought of.
Oh yeah.
Where in order to get to that deadpan, illogical, humorous answer, you have to first understand the logic to break it, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. I agree with that.
Everyone was posting the, I didn't even know Hitler was sick.
Right. Yeah, that's Norm Macdonald Live. Yeah.
Right. And everyone was saying, oh, like, this was a reference to the fact that he was sick. And I was like, this is just a really great punchline. And that's less mathematical. Maybe even breaking down to just why jokes are funny in the first place. It's like you're breaking the expected punchline.
Right.
A plus B usually leads to C, but here we're getting D.
Yeah, but it's not like it's a completely random thing either, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he says, I didn't even know Hitler was sick, the joke of it is sort of like, that's a thing you say about somebody that you wish well or something. It's like not a thing that, you know, he's like underplaying the guy's a dictator.
Mm-hmm.
So, not a dictator. I mean, he's a dictator, but the underplaying is the genocide. So it's not like you're just saying something random. And that's the thing that appeals to me. Because I remember somebody once said to Norm that he really liked that Norm did anti-comedy. And then Norm gives this whole rant about how he doesn't like anti-comedy because he's trying to make jokes. Like, he's actually trying to say something that's funny. And I empathized with that a lot. So there is always, even when you twist the logic, you're twisting it from the logic that you know it could play out. Or what's funny about the twist of logic is that it evokes the structure of something logical. Whereas if it's just, for example, here's a Monty Python thing I don't like that much. In The Meaning of Life, they have this thing about this guy with the long, weird arms and the fishes. I don't remember exactly what it is, but do you remember the scene I'm talking about? I think it's Terry Jones. I don't remember actually who plays it, but he has these long arms. He's instructing the viewer to look at fish on the screen.
I know that what you're referencing, yeah.
Yeah. It's some just weird, random thing. And the whole joke of it, as far as I can tell, is just that he's being weird and random. And I see so many sketch shows like this. I go to a lot of live comedy, and I see so many things that are just like this. They're just going to be weird and random. And I'm like, I could stay at home and be random. I came to you to see an idea that you had fleshed out that I wouldn't have thought of, so I forget what I'm saying with this, but to me, it's always funny to, I don't even remember what I'm saying, but what I'm saying is the jokes of Norm's that I like, I mean, I like almost everything Norm does, but usually it's because I can see that there's a clear structure to them. He's not just flailing around hoping you'll find him wacky, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, just like rock, paper, scissors isn't a great game because the ideal strategy is to be random.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a very low form of humor to just fill in a random word somewhere. And similarly, when you're talking about other comedians that, you know, you're saying they're not doing math. Well, in the way they're coming up with their joke, they're doing a form of math, just like people may be doing math in real life, but they're not realizing it. They're doing their own, okay, well, this is what we've set up. What would be something funny to come in here that would subvert expectations?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So like I said, I feel like a lot of comedians good comedians have this Latin skill of playing with logic. It's like, okay, I set this up. Now, what would flow from this in a way where if this were true, then this would be true, or this clearly breaks what would be true if this were true, then this would be true, but the fact that it clearly isn't doing the expected thing is funny or whatever. A lot of comedians are good at reasoning about that if they're good comedians, even though they never would do any formal math, but it's the same muscle, yeah.
Well, I guess comedy hasn't been solved yet by an AI. May or may not be in our lifetime, and it certainly wasn't when Airplane 1980 was released, but why would you say Airplane is your favorite movie?
It is just so jam-packed with jokes, and I didn't even remember how jam-packed with jokes it was, which is incredible. I knew it was jam-packed with jokes, but I just rewatched it before this podcast, and I'm just blown away by how many of them come so frequently, and even the little one-off gags. It'll take a one-off gag and it'll find ways to heighten it and do second and third beats. You know, like there's this joke in the middle of the movie that I can remember right now. Well, it's towards the beginning, but the crew are setting up the pilots are in the cockpit. They're just having idle chatter. And there's this guy who comes to the windshield and he kind of wipes the windows. And you're like, oh, that's funny, first of all. Like you wouldn't have like a gas station window wiper in an airplane. But then that same joke, they do three more things with it. So he wipes the windows, then he pops the hood of the plane. All right, you got a second thing heightening it. Then he tries to pop the hood back in place and it bounces him off and he falls because he's high up. And you're like, oh, okay. They found a third thing to do with this. And then it goes away to another scene and it comes back and there's a guy in the window and he hands like a payment credit card, like swiping processing thing to the guy, like they're paying for the gas station. They found four things to do with this little tiny like background one-off gag. And all of that happens in like a minute. Like every minute of this movie is just full of like four or five jokes. Whereas now, if you watch a comedy now, you'll get like one joke every 10 minutes. Like there'll be six jokes in a movie or nine jokes in a movie. So it's like, that's what's incredible about Airplane to me.
Well, I definitely noticed it. Even before we get there, we have the people over the PA arguing.
Yes.
You have the main character, Ted, I think. He lets the guy in the taxi and then he starts the thing and then leaves him. And then the guy tries to put the flower on his jacket and he just ditches the jacket. And that all happens in like 30, 45 seconds.
That's all in the first minute of the movie. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, the very first joke of the movie is his Jaws parody thing, which is fine. It's fine. But then once we get into the real movie after the credits, or you know, after that Jaws opening, like you said, the first thing is that announcements of the parking zones. And it comes on not not feeling like a joke right away, because it takes a second for them to turn it into the arguing and the you really want an abortion thing. But still, the first thing they're doing is setting up a joke. And then I was counting in the first 5 minutes, and I think it was like 20 jokes in the first 5 minutes. So I watch a movie now and it takes 15 minutes to get to the first like real joke, you know? So yeah, that's what I really like about it.
Yeah, I feel like nowadays in comedies, and I can hardly even think of like a recent comedy that came out that I like really enjoyed, but it's more about star power.
Yeah.
And having a message, and we've really got to have some kind of moral at the end of it or something. We need to say something.
Exactly.
You know, the generation right now is obsessed with saying something, and you don't really get, I mean, the last thing I can think of, last piece of media I consume that I can really think of that is constantly throwing jokes at you would be like either 30 Rock or Community.
Yeah, I was going to say 30 Rock. Exactly. 30 Rock to me. So we were talking about the Zaz style of a million jokes a minute, and there's a few other things that have that style. Some of the Mel Brooks movies are like that also. Like they'll just break all the rules and do a bunch of gags every, you know, minute. And then in TV, yeah, like 30 Rock and Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Tina Fey stuff. But yeah, that's like the only thing I can think of in any recent time. And like you were saying, Community has jokes too. But I really think 30 Rock is sort of the spiritual successor to Airplane and this style. Sorry, I'm just kind of repeating myself. Just saying 30 Rock over and over. But I love 30 Rock too.
No, but you're right.
Yeah, yeah.
It is a gag a minute. And if you blink, if you look at your phone for too long, like I know you were watching this movie right before we started recording and taking notes on it. And I was watching it last night. And, you know, in the last half of the movie, I might have been texting somebody or something. So I rewatched it today and I caught all these cutaway gags that I didn't get.
Yeah, exactly.
Last night. Because if you look away for a minute, you miss two or three jokes.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was getting questions about what we were going to eat for dinner. And I kept having to pause and go back because I knew there would be I knew there'd be a subtle joke in there that I missed. And the way they do it, I think, real well in this too, is they just pack in, like, it's not all just wordplay. It's not all situational comedy. It's not all absurdity. There's also, and I'm not even a big like slapstick humor guy, but then there's just a random bit of it that just works so perfectly, like grabs a guitar and just slaps like eight people along the way and then rips out the IV from the girl. Just like a lot of stuff like that where it didn't get too stale, any of the jokes, but yeah, I had watched this movie as a kid and I remember finding it really funny. I was like, I know when I go back and rewatch it, there's going to be 100 adult jokes I didn't get. And there's probably 300, you know, this like constant level of this thing I definitely didn't get. I remember what caught me really off guard was like the whacking materials at the magazine station in the airport. Like that just hit me right. That's the perfect joke for me.
Yeah. And even that joke, again, they heighten it. So I saw the whacking material. And I was like, okay, that's funny. But then also he brings up the magazine that he's reading from the whacking material section. And there's another joke there because I think it's called Modern Semen or something. And it's done like it's like a classy, like adult, like literate, you know, sophisticated magazine. So even with every little one-off joke, they still try and like pack even more into it.
Yeah, and that was just a throwaway joke too. Like you could have watched the movie and not even noticed either of those.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a purely visual background joke in a way. It's not purely background, like it's in the foreground literally, but you know what I mean. Yeah.
I also appreciate the investment in things like we're hearing that his name is Over early on.
Yes.
Also, if you're going to make that joke, like you're committed to these names now for the rest of and this is all for a good bit, I think. I mean, it lands for me every time I watch it. A lot of it is also the delivery.
Right.
Something like that where you're investing, I feel like, a lot in a gag that pays off well, in my opinion, but quickly, early on. And then this isn't like the cleverest joke in the world, but it is, again, I feel like Roger, Roger, Over, Over works. And then What's Your Vector, Victor is heightening it.
Right.
That's the one you wouldn't think of off the top of your head. Not that everyone's thinking Roger, Roger first. Although now, as soon as I said that, I obviously thought of Phantom Menace. Yeah, I feel like there is a lot of, maybe it's like love for it, where it's like, yeah, we're willing to do this and it's going to pay off later on.
Yeah.
Like it feels like they're invested in the comedy aspect in every front.
Yes, exactly. And I was impressed by that too, because I didn't realize also how early they set that up and then you only get that later on. And then even when that scene starts, I noticed the joke isn't fully clear when it starts. You just see Roger being like, huh, but you don't really know his name is Roger yet. And it takes a while for you to realize, oh, his name is Roger and that guy's name is Victor and so on. And there was a couple other moments like this I can't remember, but where I was surprised to realize how early they set something up that paid off later. Because in my head I'm thinking, oh, this is a gag a minute movie, so they just write a bunch of disconnected gags and they just plop them in. Actually, there's more care that they've put into it. Like, they set things up early on, they thread things through, which is very surprising in a way. But yeah, I wish I could remember some of these other examples, but...
Well, I feel like Otto is the gift that keeps on giving.
Oh yeah, that's true.
They utilize Otto pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. What all do they do with Otto? Of course, there's the fellatio.
And then he gropes her later.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
And then he flies away at the very end.
Yeah, that's right. And even just the idea, of course, first of all, the original joke is autopilot is an inflatable pilot. Like, that's a funny joke. That's a beautiful joke. Yeah, that is a good one. Yeah. Sorry, I'm rambling. But yeah. And then there's another interesting thing about Airplane is they actually do different styles of jokes. They're not all the same thing, which again, I was sort of surprised to realize, although I knew it on some level. Like, yeah, okay, there'll be wordplay and slapstick and whatever things that you might think are straight up normal gag things, but there's kinds of jokes in the movie that aren't even my favorite. Like, even though it's my favorite movie, not everything in it hits for me. So for example, there's that character, oh, I forgot his name, it's like Hinsho or something. He's like the mincing gay guy. I don't remember what his name is. A lot of his stuff is just kind of randomness, wackiness. He's like, it's a twister and stuff like that. That stuff doesn't hit for me, but I still appreciate that he's in there to make the movie hit for all kinds of people. Like, it's fine. It's fine to me to have jokes that aren't my favorite, that aren't up my alley. As long as there's a million other jokes, it's like, if you don't like a joke, wait 15 seconds. There'll be another one, you know?
Yeah, and I didn't love that character either. And then everyone's freaking out about the news. And then he goes, there's a sale at Penny's, like in ultra gay voice. Like, that even got me really hard. But otherwise, I felt kind of like you, like his outbursts weren't specifically for me, but then, you know, one or two in there that like really got me.
The Penny's one I liked also, because there's a kind of logic to it that everybody else is freaking out about things in the newspaper. So he's reading another thing you would read in a newspaper and it inverts the pattern. Whereas the ones that he does that are just like, I don't know.
Knee John, big tall tree or whatever that is.
There's a kind of logic to that one too, but it's not that strong for me, because it's like the guy says, you, Marcius, you, Fred, or whatever, me, John, I get it. But yeah, that one isn't great. And Leon is getting larger. That's the line a lot of people like. But again, just kind of him being a sort of weird mincing gay guy. I sound very homophobic all of a sudden.
Well, I think that's also like a product of like the time and when this movie came out.
Yeah.
There's a few jokes that don't necessarily age fantastic.
That's true. There's a few jokes that are definitely products of the time. Although that actor really was gay, so in a way it's sort of progressive of them to be giving him the opportunity to be that way. He was in their previous thing too, Kentucky Fried Movie, I believe. And it's sort of sad also, he died of AIDS. He had symptoms of AIDS very early on before people even knew what AIDS was. But anyway, despite that, I still don't really like him. But even then, still, the movie works for me that it does all these different kinds of jokes. Yeah, well, you're saying about product of the times also. There's some of the racial stuff, like, I like a lot of the racial stuff. Like, it's still really funny to me. And it's like, to me, if people can't laugh at the fact that the tribe of black people are all really good at basketball immediately, then they have too much of a stick up their ass. Like, the joke there is kind of also that the white guy thinks he's going to be teaching them something, and they're all way better than him. Like, who is he to think he's going to teach them? But also, so it's just a joke that stereotypically black guys.
And the first thing he thinks to teach them is basketball.
That's true. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I thought that was one of my favorite scenes of his like reminiscing PTSD, telling a very long drawn out story to someone who then wants to kill himself. Was the tribe of people all good at basketball. That was killing me. That was one of my favorite bits. And that was when I was specifically thinking, like, I think, you know, if I showed this to any of my black friends, they would laugh at it, you know.
Right.
It's a great joke. Like,
it's a great joke. Exactly. There's another joke about black people that I don't like that much, or about African people. But whatever. I mean, not all jokes have to be my favorite, but there's this thing where there's this newscaster in an African country, and he's like really primitively dressed, and he's just banging on a drum and whatever. And that more feels to me like, I don't know, it's like, come on, do you really think a newscaster in an African country is like that? But whatever, it's still kind of funny. And then there's the jive talk, which I imagine people would have a problem with, but I think those jive talk scenes really work, even though basically the thing they do in those jive talk scenes later on becomes... Like, in the world, it's a kind of stale joke that people used to do when I was a kid, of like ebonicizing fairy tales or something. And so it became a kind of quasi-racist thing, and it was very cliched. But Airplane did it early on, before it was stale. Like, the whole thing of, you know, he's just talking in slang. Basically, it's a joke about slang, even though there is a racial element to it. It's a joke about the guy is talking in slang, and you do the subtitles that play it up like, well, we are faced with a moral quandary, or whatever the fuck it is in the subtitle. And, you know, it's a funny incongruity of you know, you can take an old-timey classy at the, you know, it's all ingrained in our heads that the old-timey thing is classy and slang is not classy, even though that's not really true. But that joke works for me, even though I imagine there are a million people I would show this to today on like the stick up your ass corner of Twitter or something who would be like, that's a racist joke about Jive. They shouldn't have done that. Yeah.
That was definitely the joke that I noticed as being the one that I would assume people would notice the most out of it. Gardner, I do have to, because I mentioned it beforehand to him when we were just briefly talking about our initial thoughts before the recording, and he said, no, I think the newscaster one is probably the one that is aged the poorest, I guess.
Yeah.
I will say, though, I do agree that that can be done well, and again, not that, like, I mean, I don't have a say in the matter, obviously.
Right.
Also, on a different plane, like, who's to say what's better comedy, but maybe I'm wrong about this. I thought some of it, though, was just, it was clearly a white guy writing what he thought, like, or maybe I'm wrong and slang has changed, or I don't know.
Well, actually, this is an interesting thing. I looked up about the history of those scenes, and I looked at the original shooting script. The very first jive exchange they have is what the white writers wrote.
Okay.
But later on, what the white writers wrote in the shooting script is really bad, and they didn't use it.
Oh.
And the black actors improvised the later jive scenes after the first one. So that, again, also makes it work better for me, though. Like, the later ones, when they're talking to Barbara Billingsley and stuff, that was what the black writers came up with, and I think those are good. But it is interesting, if you look at the shooting script, you do kind of feel like these guys are being a bit racist in how, in just how inarticulate they think black people speak. Yeah, yeah.
There was just, I think there was one line where it was like, I don't remember what it was, and I wish I have to rewatch it. It translated to like a colloquial type thing, like one of those like sayings where I forget what it was.
Yeah, probably early to bed and early to rise. Yeah, healthy, wealthy, whatever. That particular one was written by the white guys, that particular thing.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, I feel a little bit better in my, like, because it was that line that stuck out to me.
Yeah, yeah. I forget exactly what the slang they had them say is, but that's the one they wrote. And then the later times when they come back to the jive aren't the ones they wrote. So
right. Maybe
you have a good ear for for white guyisms. Yeah.
I almost thought they were playing it up, like how...
Oh, the black guys were definitely playing up how much slang they were putting in. Yeah, yeah.
Almost like the joke is the white people can't understand them when...
Yeah.
Yeah, like that sort of thing.
I agree in the sense that it pays off twice, I think. One, just in a comedic sense, where I think having the old white lady be quote-unquote fluent is like, that's a good bit, maybe. You know, I mean, like not my favorite bit in the movie, but I think it's worth
it. Right.
It also, I think, pays off a little bit in the sense where I feel like even like things that maybe didn't age well, I don't think that they were malicious. And again, who am I to say that, but where she tries to train and she's like, he's like, what do you mean? He's like, my mama didn't raise no fool, I think is.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like,
he's like, I fucking understand. I'm not stupid. Like,
exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's particularly the same thing as the basketball thing in a way. It's like the white people think the black people need their help more than they do. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. That was sort of my point. Like, it almost the white people are the butt of the joke because they can't even try to understand, you know? And then, oh, we're going to go to the one grandma who has the, you know, level of understanding.
Although she did do a really good job. I mean, that actress. Another thing about aging poorly or aging weirdly, though, is I wonder, do people now who watch the movie realize that actress is Barbara Billingsley from Leave It to Beaver? So that's part of the joke, is that she's this very well-known, like, straight-laced white American family actress who's now doing this role. But, you know, if a kid watches that movie today, no kid now ever watches Leave It to Beaver, right? So same way, they had a couple other things like that. Like, the guy in the taxi was Howard Jarvis, right?
Or the one of Ted's squad mates, he thinks he's
Ethel Merman. Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Right over my head.
Yeah, that's also something that, you know, things can age poorly in a way where people might not understand what the joke originally was, and then they'll think the joke is something else and they'll make something up in their head. That sometimes happens.
But I do think that, like, almost everything else is pretty timeless. Like, I think that the combination of wordplay and slapstick and sight gags without relying too much on cultural references, they're here and there for like the audience, but for the most part, like, I was still laughing my ass off throughout this movie. I wasn't worried about the time period when it came out because it was just clever.
Yeah, well, also it's an interesting thing that happens, like, you know, with Looney Tunes or something, they have so many references that are of their age, but still the jokes all work, so people keep watching them, and people don't need the original references to understand all the other jokes around, or so that happens with lots of things. Yeah, I don't know, if a movie, so this is the advantage of having many different kinds of jokes in the same movie. Like I was saying, they don't all have to hit for it still to be like a timeless classic. Yeah. So I was going to say another clever thing that I knew they did, but I was happy to really observe it again, is this is a movie ostensibly all set in an airplane or all set in an airport. So you would think, oh, I'm going to get tired of this. But they set up all these flashbacks to just let them do these jokes in other locations, like the bar in Drambuie. There's also this, you know, just completely in the background gag that all the foreign cities are named Drambuie and Daiquiri and after drinks and stuff. But, you know, there's the bar in Drambuie. There's the From Here to Eternity parody on the beach. And there's the basketball thing with the Peace Corps in Africa. So they make sure to have things that switch it up and give it dynamics instead of just, all right, another scene in an airplane or another scene in an airport. And also it gives them room to do just more jokes. Like any joke idea they could come up with, some joke ideas you come up with, they're not going to take place in an airplane, right? So I thought that was clever of them to structure the movie that way.
We were talking about the not just different locations to spice it up, but also, like you were saying, different types of jokes. There's something for everyone like that. And we keep calling it clever, and it really is. And that's true, but it's also like blowjobs are funny, right? You know, it's like stuff like that.
Right. Also, there are jokes that are just purely like silly, crude, whatever. Like, yeah, I like to have that mix, like I was saying with Monty Python, of cleverness and silliness, or even cleverness and crudeness. You know, I like that. So yeah, blowjobs are funny.
I think I have one gripe with this movie, and you guys can let me know if you feel the same way. And it's less the movie itself, but the sort of cultural phenomenon it creates. But so they do this thing, running gag throughout it, where someone's asking a very serious question, and then they condescendingly say, oh, the hospital, what is it? And
yeah,
it's,
right.
Oh, you know, it's large building with a bunch of patients, but that's not important right now. And I think it's really funny and really well done in the movie. But then you get a bunch of people that watch the movie and they make it their personality trait to be very pedantic and literal in real life.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think it kills me because my dad would always do this. He would always respond in that same sort of way whenever you ask a question or don't call me Shirley. And it's like, it's not always funny out in the real world when something serious is going on. It's funny when I'm watching this obvious comedy movie.
You're saying your dad would do this to you in real, like, grave, serious situations?
You know, not like life or death, but, you know, sometimes you're like, hey, I need an answer. Don't call me Shirley or something, you know.
I see.
Son, your grandma's in the hospital. Yeah. What is it?
I wouldn't put it past him.
I don't think my dad has done that particular thing to me, or I don't know. But I can definitely, there are people who have that kind of personality. And I sometimes worry if I teeter into that kind of personality too, where it's like, you're just kind of flailing for a joke and you don't need a joke right now. Let's just have a real conversation. There's definitely that phenomenon, yeah.
Well, I think if you're self-aware about it, then you don't need to worry about it.
Oh, okay, okay. Now I have to worry whether I'm self-aware enough. But yeah, also just in general, there's this phenomenon of people watch comedy and then they make it their personality, not to come up with original jokes, but just to do the thing from the comedy they saw, just to quote it or do the same gag. And that's not funny, or that's not that clever. It's like, no, you should have been inspired by that to sit and think up new jokes, you know? It's like, you know, there used to be all these people who would just quote Monty Python all the time, or, you know, talk about nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition or shit. I don't know. It's not funny. You're just referencing something. It was funny when I saw the other thing in the context and whatever. So, you know, or people would quote SNL or whatever.
I bet you like current SNL then, since they're pretty much regurgitating like jokes that have already been made. Although I did like older SNL.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like everybody else, I feel like there were some things in old SNL that were good and current SNL is shit. But also when you watch old SNL, most of it is shit too, and you just kind of remember the good parts.
Yeah, it is hit or, it's very hit or miss too. And some of the, like, the classic ones, like, how funny is that?
Right.
Like, yeah, the cowboy one was good, like, once, but it's like, does that have staying power? Like, why is that one, like,
yeah,
so much in my, like, I don't know, it is, like, one bit there, right? Like, they, like, do they really escalate it in the cowboy one? And now I'm just shitting on, like, one that people love. I don't know.
Yeah, you're right. The cowbell one kind of got juiced by the fact that Jimmy Fallon is cracking up in the background, right? Or is it Jimmy Fallon and Horatio Sands?
Yeah, I guess that is true.
And so that kind of made it become a viral clip at one point. But yeah, like you're saying, it's not really that interesting structurally. It's okay. I mean, it's fine. So yeah, it is weird to watch old SNL and realize even like the classic, like the first season of SNL that blew up and put them on the map, and the sketches that they thought were so funny were like Jim Belushi as a samurai, and he's not really doing anything. He's just being a samurai, or I don't know. It's like comedy is sometimes saddled with this, that it's very of the moment sometimes also. Like, it's only funny because nobody else is doing stuff like that right now. And then you watch it 20 years later, and it's not that subversive or anything anymore. And you're like, what's the big deal? But I will grant that that doesn't mean it wasn't funny at the time. But it is interesting that sometimes comedy can age just not that great because it's so contextual sometimes. Same way, a lot of the racial stuff, actually, even if we say it ages poorly, a lot of it has this funniness in the time because it's subversive. It's like, oh my God, did he even say that? Like, it's not like it wasn't outrageous sometimes even at the time, but it's like maybe it was much less common for people to make edgy jokes in a world where there was only so many avenues you would even go to see comedy or whatever. So it's sort of juiced to see something edgy at the time. And then 20 years later, you watch it and you're like, yeah, it's just kind of flailing edginess. I think that happens a lot too. But for example, there are like a million sitcoms that did some kind of variation on the joke of some character getting into blackface and it being portrayed as, oh, it's a horrible thing they did, but isn't it wild and wacky to be showing someone in blackface? And I don't really think there's anything wrong with it morally or ethically to make a show like that. I don't think they should have taken all these shows down from streaming like they did. Like, they took down episodes of everything, Community and 30 Rock and the Mr. Show revival and Golden Girls, and every fucking show from the 90s and 2000s had one episode where someone was in blackface for this one kind of gag. I think those shows are fine on moral and ethical grounds, but I do think it's kind of a lazy gag that they're all doing the same thing. If only one of them had done it, it would be fine, but everybody doing it. But I also get why it felt more subversive or something at the time, maybe. At the time, first of all, you weren't watching every episode of everything. You'd see whatever was on TV that you happened to catch when it was broadcast. So you would reuse a joke somebody did, and it's fine. And just the wild outrageousness of it was sort of coded differently. Like, so I don't know where I'm going with this, but I feel that phenomenon happens a lot with comedy. Even a lot of stuff I do, I'm sure, will be viewed differently in 20 years, because sometimes I am going for that outrageousness shock frisson of something that at the moment is like, oh, why would he say that? Or it's reacting to something. And in 20 years, it'd be like, eh, whatever, you know?
Well, I mean, that's a good point, because like like you said, at the time it was novel, and then it's been replicated a bunch of times to the point where now it's hack.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's been discussed ad nauseum. And if you're doing it now, you know, like you said, it's kind of going back to just repeating jokes and referencing things. It's be inspired, come up with your own novel, edgy, whatever. Show us something we haven't seen before.
Yeah, exactly. Show us something we haven't seen before. This is what I think about a lot of what I watch, even though sometimes I like watching things that are similar to things I've seen before. But a lot of the times I'm like, I don't know. I want to see something new.
To talk about TV shows and comedy, like you were saying, and there being things that, for example, you were talking about blackface. Every show, it feels like, has done one. But again, to go like animated.
Right.
For all those shows where it's a family, right, and they have kids in high school or whatever, there's going to be an episode where they're teaching sex ed in the school, and the family that we're focusing on doesn't like that they're doing it, so they're going to pull their kid out, and eventually what happens is they're going to have to teach the sex ed instead.
I think King of the Hill did it.
King of the Hill definitely is one of the examples that I know did it. American Dad was another one.
Yeah.
And I know South Park did The Simpsons did it. You know, Simpsons has ran long enough that, like, every plot has been done. Like, you're going to have to do a plot that they've done and just do it differently.
Right.
But what makes it something worth watching is doing it differently, right? Or doing something that is completely brand new, like you were saying, like how Airplane was doing things that now feel maybe stale in some sense, but at the time weren't.
Yeah.
Which I feel like, you know, I know you mentioned the Beatles in a completely different context earlier, but I feel like I've heard some people nowadays can't appreciate them as well, because things that were innovative then have been now replicated by so many other artists and bands that hadn't previously been done. So it's like,
yeah,
it was like mind-blowing to hear for the first time, but now it's like, yeah, that's not like Katy Perry did that. It was like, well, yeah, she's trying to sound like she's following this, you know, musical, almost logical math thing that like the Beatles invented when they broke music. Or it might not even be the Beatles, but there are examples of musicians like that, I feel like.
Right, yeah. I mean, that happens with everything. Like, you'll do something groundbreaking, and then the very fact that you did something that everybody admired and appreciated so much means you're going to have a lot of imitators, and it's going to become hack, you know, in another decade or two. Probably in another decade, it doesn't have to take two. But yeah, like, so many things that are hack started out novel and interesting. So there's always a tension in being dismissive of the hack move itself. It's not intrinsic to it that it's hack. It's contextual with the fact that everybody is doing it and you've gotten bored of it. But it doesn't mean it never had any content that was interesting in it.
It makes me think of like the comedians who, like we talked about earlier in the episode, who just go up and go, oh, you can't say anything anymore. You know, meanwhile, playing to like a sold out audience and everything. It's like, maybe at one point that would have been an interesting discussion.
That's right. Yeah.
Backlash to the backlash. But now we're getting like backlash to the backlash to the backlash to the backlash. And it's just tired.
Yeah, exactly. This is another thing I found interesting with Twitter in particular, is it's very easy to find out how hack things are. Like, I think before I was using Twitter, I didn't realize how many joke ideas I would come up with 700 people have already come up with. But then I got into the habit of just searching searching to see who has done a joke before whenever I have an idea. And I would realize, oh yeah, a lot of people came up with this. I got to push myself to be more original. I got to not just grab for stuff that somebody else could come up with. But I think a lot of people don't do that. I don't know. I think a lot of people just are not that aware of how much unoriginality there is to the stuff they're putting up. And it's surprising to see professional comedians like this. I mean, we all know these examples. Like, you'll see a Netflix comedy special and the guy will be complaining about all the weirdly named coffees at Starbucks and I just want coffee. And it's like, are you not paying any attention to your craft? Dennis Leary did the same bit in the 90s or whatever, you know, you see something about, like we were saying, all these already triggered things, you see something about participation trophies or whatever the fuck. Like, how are people not paying attention to everything every other comedian's been saying? I don't understand how people are so insulated from it, but they don't really care to find out how hack they are.
I wonder if these older comedians think that kids are too soft these days.
Right, yeah.
I think they really just don't care.
I guess that's the thing.
I think really it is just that simple. I think the kind of anti-woke, anti-cancel culture, whatever grift is really profitable, and that's good enough for them a lot of the time.
I guess that's true. But even among the woke comedians, so to speak, also there's a lot of people who don't really pay attention to how hack they are. Just every kind of thing. I've seen so many things about, for example, I go and watch a lot of Indian stand-ups and they're all the same, and they'll all do the same jokes about dating white people when you're Indian, or about white people came to colonize us because they wanted spices and they don't even use it in their food or whatever. And that's actually a funny joke, but like, we've all heard it before already, you know, but nobody's paying any attention to whether the stuff they're doing has been done before or not. But it also is, as you said, particularly true that the anti-cancel culture, anti-woke thing is a popular, profitable grift for that particular audience. So you're definitely right about that also. I think there's just a lot of unoriginality all around, and I guess it turns out you can make a career being unoriginal. And I don't mean to prop myself up like I'm the most original person in the world either. Like, I'm sure if you look at half the stuff I've done, you can be like, it's kind of a retread of some other thing, you know.
But you're making the effort.
I'm making the effort, and the other half is good. Yeah,
it's right what you say though about it not being exclusive to woke or anti-woke. The first example I thought of was, we were talking about cancel culture, which is such a buzzword, and I feel like we've already said it too much on the podcast,
right?
I feel like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, just makes me roll my eyes every time.
I know. Yeah, I feel dumb just saying it. How many examples are there of like people actually like having like real consequences,
right,
that aren't like, no, this is sexual crimes and they're like, it's not right. Cancel culture. That's like Law and Order being, I don't know, when did that become the same thing? But whatever, I obviously digress there. But it's not just the complaining about it on that sense. It's the first example, like I said, that comes to mind is that Sarah Silverman bit that went around where I forget what she was even saying. I'm just like, oh, am I going to get canceled, Detroit, or whatever? You're going to get woke on me right now? Like, after, like, she said, like, something, like, not, like, offensive. You know what I mean? Like, something, like...
Was this Sarah Silverman? I feel like I saw, like, a...
I think it's Whitney Cummings.
Whitney Cummings. Oh, yeah. Sorry. That's me getting white women confused. That's misogynist.
Right,
for sure.
I see.
The Sarah Silverman has the feet commercial, right? That's the one that's been pissing me off when I'm watching something. She has some, like, weird feet Uber commercial that's going on.
Say less, dude.
I know, it sounds super weird out of context. It's a fucking real thing, and it's like, I don't know. She's, like, talking about feet or something on it. She's, like, selling feet pictures, I think.
I haven't seen this particular commercial, but I believe you.
Yeah, that's why I got him confused.
I went to Google so fast.
No, she's like trying to get you to go. I swear to God, I didn't. But she's like, there's a website. It's like the...
Yeah.
Remember GoDaddy when they had Danica Patrick like getting naked and it was like, oh, we sell websites? And I was like 12 and I definitely watched the Super Bowl and went to fucking GoDaddy.com. And I was like, well, I was like, I don't need a website though. I think it's like domains that they sell or something. I'm not sure. It's the same type thing that they're trying to do. I'm sure the website is like an Uber Eats like website. You know what I mean?
Mm.
But anyway, yes, the Whitney Cummings. That's the you know. But you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Like what you
both sides are playing on the same dumb fake concepts.
Yeah, exactly. And again, if you're Whitney Cummings, well, now I'm repeating myself. But you know, if you're Whitney Cummings, how are you at that level of comedy fame and comedy surroundings and just not paying attention to you're saying the exact same words people have been saying already for so long? I don't know how people are so insulated, but whatever. I'm saying now the exact same words I've been saying for so long. So I'll drop it.
Well, I really do think part of it also is something that I've seen a lot on Twitter too, where it's like you make up a person and then then get mad at them.
Yeah, of course.
And it's very easy to defeat a straw man.
Which is exactly what she's doing in that clip. She's like, oh, are you going to cancel me? Nobody was even really pushing back on her or anything. She just had scripted that she has to pretend they're canceling her.
That was super pre-scripted.
Yeah. But it's interesting talking about all this because it's also the case with the Zazz people, to bring it back to Airplane, that didn't one of them become very conservative and he makes a lot of kind of conservative movies now?
Yes. I was going to bring this up earlier when we were talking about some of the stuff that didn't age so well. And I was like, well, I'm going to be a little less generous on it because this guy made a movie called An American Carol, which is like a send up, I guess you could call it that. It's not very good. It's not good at all. Of like, I guess like Obama era, like liberals. And like the main character is like a version of Michael Moore, who is visited by the ghosts of like America past to appreciate how great America is. Bill O'Reilly shows up at one point and slaps him.
Yeah.
And it's just purely political. It's not really concerned with the jokes at all.
And didn't this movie come out, like, I always find this funny, this movie came out years after Michael Moore was like a leading light of left of whatever, liberal, whatever.
Yeah, it came out in like 2009 or something.
Yeah, but you know, they're hung up on him as their image of the face of the Democratic Party. It's, but yeah, I am disappointed by that. You know, I'm disappointed, of course, when I see people who have made the greatest comedy I ever appreciated, and then they lose their instinct because they're so hung up on just trying to trigger the people they think are their enemies or make a point that they lost track of the jokes, you know? If American Carol, if it had jokes in it, then even though I'd be like, this is a dumb movie politically, I wouldn't be disappointed the same way.
Yeah, like we've said many times in this episode, it just comes down to, is it funny?
Right.
Regardless of what message you're trying to push or whatever.
Yeah, and obviously people have said this a bunch, but it's dumb to need someone, you know, whether it be comedy or just like acting, for example, or anyone in the media who you appreciate its work to like also agree with you on like politics. Because also there's like no one agrees with everyone on 100%. You know what I mean? But it is sad when it's like, all right, now it's affecting the art, obviously. Either way they go, like, you know, even if someone gets like too into like something that I agree with, it's like, all right, man, like, why are you preaching to me? And that's what we were saying, where on a lesser note, obviously, movies that have a message in our comedies like aren't like inherently bad. Like, it's good to like have those as well. But it is something that's maybe not unique is the right word, but like it is an aspect, I think, that adds to this, that it is just here for the comedy. And there is, like we said, no message either way. And does feel, even if, all right, now that I'm hearing this for the first time, a third, it sounds like, of the creators maybe don't have the best intentions. Even the parts, like I said, that don't age perfectly, don't feel like they're specifically trying to like punch down.
Yeah, even though that guy became a conservative guy, I don't think he was trying to punch down when he made this movie. I think that's something that happened later on, that he got wound up in that. Exactly. But again, this goes to the point also of contextuality of comedy in a way, because in the current moment, there's so few comedies to try to be pure jokes and so many that are trying to deliver messages or whatever, that currently I am so impressed when I have a movie in front of me that's all jokes. That's such a breath of fresh air to me. But if it were the case that everything I saw was all jokes, then a movie that tried to have comedy with a message would be a breath of fresh air, and I'd be impressed with that. You know, it's just, what am I not seeing currently? That's what's interesting to me, you know? Because I remember also the first time that, for example, it wasn't the first thing to do this or anything, but the first season of BoJack Horseman I thought was really interesting because it doesn't set itself up like it's going to be an emotional thing or anything. It starts off like it's just a dumb cartoon that's all jokes or whatever. And by the end of the season, it slowly reveals it's about depression and these characters' lives, whatever they're struggling with. And I thought that was really interesting. And later seasons were all the same, and every show is kind of like that now. Every comedy is about trauma and whatever, and it's become less interesting. But it's just a contextual thing, you know? Or the first time I saw Futurama doing those episodes that make your throat well up at the end, like Luck of the Fryrish and Jurassic Park. Luck of the Fryrish hits me way harder than Jurassic Park, but they're both whatever. They're both, you know, tearjerkers. That was way before everybody was doing it. I mean, and so it really hit hard. But now in the world where every comedy is about trauma, that stuff is less interesting. But if everything went back to being purely all jokes, like if everything was all jokes, like, I don't know. I mean, things did used to be like that at one point, then that stuff would be interesting again. Anyway, I also want to make one acknowledgement, which is that I'm saying it's tired when people all say the same thing you could hear everybody say, but it's also true that in our circles, I'm sure a million people talk about how funny it is and how stupid it is that everyone rails against cancel culture and the grift of it all and whatever. So in a way, we're all also saying things that you can hear a million people have said before, but that's fine. That happens. We're not on stage saying it is our great comedic routine right now, you know. We're just having a conversation tying it into being about Airplane.
Oh Well, yeah, to be fair, I think that people listening to this are aware that in general, I don't think that people think that they're coming to us with us saying that we are the first to say anything. More right, just like you were right. saying, having a conversation, you know.
I just wanted to guard myself against mm-hmm. the imagined enemy who points out my hypocrisy. Like, I'm always on guard for my hypocrisy. So I'm saying you should be original and I'm being unoriginal. Well, whatever. I'm just a person.
Right.
Well,
right.
I think a part of that is a symptom of, like, the internet and social media age where, you know, a billion people are on it. And so it's very easy for an idea to circulate and for everyone to say it. And then you've got the contrarian take, which is now fresh.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And then everyone jumps on that bandwagon and it goes around and around and around.
The speed of this thing, and again, I'm not saying anything originally here, but the speed of this thing is so accelerated now compared to, you know, when I was younger and internet culture didn't exist in such a flowering yet. Like, it used to be if you had a contrarian take, it would still be pretty fresh to everybody for like 5 years. Now it's like within a week, you've heard it already a million times and everybody's on to the contrarian take and whatever. But yeah.
Yeah. And it goes back to what we were saying about like silliness and the things that didn't age well, and now it's like at the time they were transgressive and now they're dated, and at one point no one was saying them so they were interesting. I think that all kind of ties back together.
Yeah. And suddenly, have you guys watched like any of the Zazz TV shows, like Police Squad and stuff?
I haven't.
Just clips.
I have not. I'm planning on it after this rewatch. I gotta check something else out.
Yeah, I also haven't really seen much of them. But this inspired me that I want to go check them out. It's weird. I've never really checked them out. I've been aware of them, but and you know, Airplane's been my favorite movie a long time, but it's just, you know, when I was younger, it was hard to get a hold of. And then recently I just haven't bothered, I guess. But yeah.
I've seen The Naked Gun. I really want to see Top Secret. That's supposed to be really good.
Yeah, I've seen Naked Gun and Top Secret. I've seen all the movies, but the TV shows I haven't seen. Another thing, actually, have you guys watched Kentucky Fried Movie? I've never gone back and watched that either.
I have not.
But yeah, John Landis, there's another guy who maybe was, you know, maybe made good movies when he was younger, and then you had to be disappointed by him later on. Not necessarily on a filmmaking level, but on a moral level.
Yeah, runs in the family, I guess.
Oh, right. His kid is the Chronicle guy? Max Landis. Yeah, yeah.
Max Landis, yeah.
Right, yeah. But at least Max Landis never, you know, negligently killed three people.
Oh, shit. Was Max Landis the Twilight Zone?
Yeah, John Landis movie? Was the Twilight Zone.
Or John Landis. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's right.
Oh, fuck. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Well, hell of a note to segue
actually. Well, we can segue on one other note. I want to mention one anecdote. It's just a little anecdote from my life. It's not that interesting, but it relates to Airplane. For years and years, you know, there's that scene in Airplane where they're watching on the airplane movie, a disaster movie about an airplane that blows up, right? And it's such a funny idea. Like, yeah, you would never show a movie like that as your one movie on the airplane that everybody has to watch. But for years and years, it was my fantasy that someday I could watch the movie Airplane on an airplane watching that particular scene. But I didn't want it to be that I bring the movie Airplane onto an airplane. I just wanted it to be the airplane offers the movie Airplane and I watch the movie Airplane on an airplane with the scene in the movie Airplane of them watching an airplane movie with the airplane blowing up in an airplane. You see what I'm saying? But I thought, no, they're never going to do this. But I was on a flight a few years ago and Airplane was among the movies they offered and they left that scene in, and I thought, I have finally accomplished what I needed to do with this movie. So that's my story.
I love it. So without holding you here too much longer, I want to give you the floor to give your final thoughts and your rating out of 100. Bring your own unit on Airplane.
My final thoughts are, it's such a good movie. I knew I liked it, but I watched it now and I'm so jealous. Like, I complain about how jokeless other people are sometimes. I'm like, I write real jokes. But then I watched this movie and I thought, I'm shit. Like, I don't write things nearly as jam-packed as this. So it's just such a good movie. Even though it's flawed, it's perfect. I give it 9 out of 9 niners.
Okay, Jeff?
So I similarly, like, I knew I had seen it before and thought it was really funny. I was overwhelmed with how funny I thought it was. I thought that some of the just pure, not even absurdity, but like, is there a doctor on the plane and she goes to him wearing a stethoscope? Like, he wouldn't be wearing a stethoscope on a plane, but just some of that level of like really dumb joke, but like also a really funny joke, like really sat well with me. And I do think that there's something about this movie that it's so low stakes. You know, if you could drag a theme out of it or a cause. I guess it might even be PTSD, but that's such a like non-factor in the movie. They're basically making fun of him. You know, they're driving in the car and they said, you know, he's one of those men that he thinks too much inside or something. And maybe you know the type, just almost just even still mocking the idea.
Right.
I thought all along, just the pacing and the jokes were really good. It's really pleasant to watch a movie now that's like an hour and 20 minutes flat and then still has so much content to it. So I was shocked at, I knew I was going to like it. I knew it was a really good movie. I hadn't seen it in a while, but I was shocked at how much I liked it. I will go with 95 out of 100. I like my, or what would she say? I take it black. Like I like my men, like the little six-year-old girl and the little white gentleman kid is just absolutely shocked. And along with what we've been discussing, like maybe that joke wouldn't be, I mean, I think you could probably get away with that joke today if done right, but it's still, it's not offensive. It's not punching down. It's just the kid's reaction and the absurdity of a like, seven-year-old girl saying that. So that's my long way of saying I really like the movie.
Duncan?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of the things that we talked about, the jam-packed nature of it, the different aspects of comedy. For me, I think also the different aspects were really mostly well done, so a lot of it did work for me because I think the overall comedy style that it's remembered for, even though it's like different ones, is the surreal slash wordplay jokes that are all, you know, like Forbes, you said, people like your dad are still using to verbally annoy their kids.
I can't say the word Shirley in front of them.
It's definitely a dad movie.
Yeah, well, I'm older than you, but my dad loved it too. I mean, he talks about how he saw it in theaters when it came out and whatever.
But so those that it's most remembered for, I feel like, are definitely up my alley when it comes to comedy. So it is, even though it's dipping its toe into pretty much every aspect of comedy, I think what it really leans into is the style that I really like, and it's really well done. And I think it's somehow ahead of its time, but also has aged in a way where people today, I don't think, appreciate it, like we said, as much. Like, you could show someone who loves Superbad this movie and they might not laugh because it could be a, you know, it's just different comedy. And I think Superbad's a good example because I think it's one of the more well done comedies of that raunchy nature. But, you know, a guy who loves American Pie, for example, which is maybe a little bit underneath, is not gonna necessarily love this style of humor, even though, like we said, it's got blowjobs and stuff like that. It's still different, but ahead of its time, of course. So I'm gonna give it 96 Shirley's out of 100.
Yeah, I don't know what I can say that y'all haven't said already. I laughed all the way through it. I watched it when I was younger. Most of it went over my head. I didn't really get it. I do remember watching it with my buddy and we weren't really laughing. And then at one point he just looks at me and he goes, "Ooh, titties." And that is not the highlight for me anymore. I just think it's hysterical. And I'm going to give it 96 steak dinners out of 100.
The tits are kind of interesting. I know we're supposed to be wrapping up, but it's interesting. This is a PG movie, but it does have fully naked breasts in it, which I don't think they would probably do in a PG movie now.
You used to be able to get away with that.
Was this before PG-13?
Yeah.
Yeah, PG-13 didn't exist yet, exactly.
They invented PG-13 for Indiana Jones, I believe, Temple of Doom. I might be wrong on that, but that's what I've heard.
I can't believe it's a PG movie. I guess, like we're saying, it's a different standard. You'd have thought some of the way the jokes are written would be not even allowed back then.
Yeah, like nothing PG for now for a movie means it's a movie targeted at kids, basically. Like,
yeah, it's like a Hello Kitty movie or something.
Yeah.
Again, it's like ahead of its time, behind its time, I guess, in the sense that it's like, in the past, it's like you could get away with certain things, but also it was like more like cover up type thing. I don't know. It's like we've gotten less puritanical. Is that the right word? I don't really know.
Less. Yeah, I would say so. Because even back in the day, like R-rated movies, like if you wanted to see something really shocking, you'd have to look to like Europe or something. Like those kinds of movies weren't being made in America.
I imagine probably now with just streaming, the ratings don't even really matter. Like probably much more watching happens just at home on streaming services than at a movie theater that cares what age you are.
Yeah, and you can like set up parental locks and stuff like that. Like it's, I don't think really anybody cares too much.
Right.
But that does wrap up our interview and our discussion with Srid. Srid, thank you so much for being here. We do have one final question for you. Is there anyone that you want to shout out before we wrap up? Comedian, filmmaker, mathematician, anybody?
Oh, a mathematician. You know what? Yeah. Well, I started to shout this out earlier. It's a stupid thing to shout out, but there's a math book called Winning Ways for Your Mathematical Plays. We were talking about the mathematics of games earlier, and I think anybody who thinks that kind of thing is interesting should go check that book out. They don't really need my shout out. It's an extraordinarily best-selling book. It's quite expensive to buy. You should go pirate it. But I think if you're interested in the math of games, that's a good book to check out. Winning Ways for Your Mathematical Plays by Burlakamp, Conway, and Guy.
Awesome. So to our audience, anyone who's interested, please go check that out. Also, I know we said it at the top of the show, but can you let the folks know where to find you online if they want to check out some of your stuff and they don't already?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Radish Harmers, like the root vegetable useful radish, and then a plurality of people who want to do harm to it. And I guess, you know, I don't really have anything else to pimp online. I mean, I can be found in various other places, but they're not worth giving a shout out to. Eventually, I'll have more stuff up, but Radish Harmers is probably the right place to go.
Awesome. You heard it, folks. Go follow Sridhar on Twitter, and thank you for tuning in. Sridhar, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking with us. This was an absolute joy. I had a great time.
I had a great time as well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming.
Yeah, thanks, man. Thanks for talking so long, too.
Yeah, no problem.
There you have it. That was our interview with Sridhar Ramesh. On behalf of all the hosts of GDT, thank you again for taking the time to talk with us and for giving such thoughtful insight throughout. The combination of math and comedy made for a really fun conversation, and we definitely hope to have Sridhar back on one day for more. Don't forget to follow him on Twitter, @RadishHarmers. Like I said at the top of the show, we will be releasing an interview later this week with filmmaker Ben Young to discuss his new film, Devil's Peak, which is in theaters now in the U.S. Ben was a great guest, and we appreciate him returning to talk with us again after joining us last year to discuss his films Hounds of Love and Extinction. So get excited for that, go see the film, and we'll be back to releasing weekly episodes starting now. That's the end of the show. Don't forforget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram @GoodDataPod, on Facebook @GDTPodcast, and remember you can find us on any podcasting app by searching the letters GDT. Any new listeners can check out our back catalog of over 80 episodes there on any of those platforms. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again soon.